This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have six bills, and we will be able to go home as soon as we're done with them, so I will encourage people to be concise in their testimony. Senator Pretner Solon, we're starting with Senate File 615.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill provides an exception to the hospital moratorium law to add 20 child and adolescent psychiatric beds to be located in western Hennepin County. Last year, this committee considered a proposal. They sought to have 144 child, adolescent, and adult beds in Woodbury. There were three main concerns about last year's plan. It was too big. It was in the wrong place. It didn't focus on just children and adolescents, which is the biggest access problem. My concern last year was that the proposal wasn't the right solution for the problem at the time. And members, we do have a problem. We have all heard the stories about the lack of access to care at a time of crisis. Patients that are forced to sit in the ER for 24 to 48 hours waiting for a bed to open up. Patients that are transported hundreds of miles away from family and friends for care. And patients that leave the ER because they don't feel welcome or that their needs are a priority for hospital staff. The problem of inadequate beds is getting worse. On Friday, there were no beds in the Twin Cities for children, and there were only four child psych beds available in the entire state. There were no adolescent beds in the Twin Cities. That's why I was pleased to hear that Prairie St. John's had really listened to the concerns that were raised last year and revised their proposal. They took the input that we and others gave them last year and worked out over the interim to address the concerns that were raised. They heard the concern that their proposal was too big. This proposal provides for just 20 beds. They heard the concern that the East Metro was the wrong location. They are looking at a site in the West Metro, which is easily accessible via Interstate 94 to central Minnesota, which has an access problem. There is an article in your packets about the problem St. Cloud is facing in access to psychiatric care. They heard that we need child and adolescent beds, not adult beds, and that is what this proposal will provide. I'm pleased with the community response to this revised proposal. The hospital community, which had concerns last year, is no longer troubled. Indeed, Prairie St. John's has been talking with several hospital systems in the West Metro about ways in which they can partner and share resources, assuming this bill is passed into law. The Department of Health, which had questions about this last year, has received information from Prairie St. John's about the revised plan, and I understand that the department does not have concerns with it. I've also not heard any concerns from the advocacy community. There have been some questions raised about whether Prairie St. John's will accept uninsured or public program patients, and Prairie St. John's has made it clear that they will. I want to emphasize one element of this proposal. In addition to 20 new inpatient beds, Prairie St. John's will also be adding 20 day treatment slots at this site, bringing to 70 the total number of day treatment slots Prairie St. John's has added to the Twin Cities since first opening in 2006. Prairie St. John's has added more outpatient mental health services than anyone else over the past several years. They are doing what we have asked the healthcare system to do, expanding needed outpatient services, but that's not enough. We still need inpatient beds for times of crisis. In conclusion, members, there are multiple benefits to this bill. It will provide greater access to care for children and adolescents suffering from severe mental illness and requiring intensive inpatient services. It will allow children and adolescents to receive services close to home, which is very important both to them and to their families. And it addresses the concerns that we and others raised about the size and location and scope of the project. And I have to say that when I'm home practicing in my community, I often find almost, at least on a weekly basis, that we have children that have transferred to us from either the metro area or western Minnesota. They are then far from their family, they are far from their community support, they are far from the programs that we need to refer them to, and it's very difficult for us to coordinate care, and it's often difficult for parents to spend time, as they have jobs, and it's often expensive for them to find places to stay in our community, too. So it's always best to treat the children in the community in which they live. At a time when we are looking at cutting or eliminating services in many areas, it's a wonderfully positive thing to carry a bill to expand services, and I hope to have your support. And with that as a background on the bill, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Shalene Kennedy, a board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist, for a few brief comments.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Chairman Marty, and Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm going to keep it brief. Some of you have heard from me before. I have three main points. I'm the child and adolescent psychiatrist treating your most severely mentally ill children in the Twin Cities at multiple different locations, one of them being the partial hospital program at Perry St. John's in Woodbury. My first point is there really and truly are not enough inpatient beds. In February, on the 27th, I tried to hospitalize a child who had been aggressive to others, who had completely destroyed an office and much other property, and when he was himself in a desensitization room, began to injure himself. After calling all around the Twin Cities, our staff was only able to find that there was potentially one bed available. When we contacted that hospital to give a report, they told us there were eight children in the emergency room at that time who would, of course, be given priority to our patient. The opportunities were not available in Minnesota, and the idea of possibly transferring this young child to Winnipeg was not out of the question. He was then managed via outpatient until we were able to find a bed available. This meant any medication change, Mom had to run back and forth to the pharmacy, very inconvenient, very dangerous for the child. Mom was not willing to transfer him out of the state. I also think that this crisis has caused premature discharge from the hospital. In the past 2 weeks, I've had two children admitted to the partial hospital, which is, of course, the highest level of care next to inpatient, and within 48 hours required readmission because they simply were not ready to be out of the hospital. Thirdly, I'd just like to say how proud I am to be a part of Perry St. John's. 10% of the kids that we saw in 2008 in our Twin Cities Partial Hospital Program were pro bono, not paid for. It's never, ever been a question when I've wanted to hospitalize a child of do they have insurance, what kind of insurance. If they have no insurance and I think the child needs to be there, they've accepted them. And just an aside note, even in our Fargo facilities last week, we were at 100% capacity, inpatient, partial hospital, and our residential program. Just an aside as well, the pro bono that we've done is not an EMTALA requirement. They've just simply done it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember what EMTALA means.
Perhaps, John, you can speak to...
Emergency medical.
I think I knew once, but I don't anymore.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Senator Marty and Senator Higgins, EMTALA is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. It's a federal law that requires hospitals to accept a patient in need of emergency medical treatment without regard to their ability to pay for the services.
Thank you.
And just to identify myself, my name is John Ryan, and I'm Special Projects Liaison for Perry St. John's.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Prentice-Holland, and you maybe covered this before I got here, and I apologize if you did. The 20 beds that we're looking at, is that going to be at capacity once it's built, or is that planning a little bit into the future for these 20 beds, or how do we come up with that number?
I think I'll let the doctor or Mr. Ryan respond to that.
I'd like to respond to that. We did have a proposal last year for a 96-bed facility, which we felt, due to the need of the community, would be filled to at or need or near capacity. So the 20-bed facility, I think, will be at or near capacity soon after it is opened. I don't know that it leaves any breathing room to bring the levels down to a 75 or an 80% occupancy. rate, which would be preferable in terms of not having to do as many transfers in between hospitals. But it will add a measure of relief that we don't currently have.
Mr. Chair, I'm curious, I guess, on this, the construction of this project. You're paying for the whole thing, private dollars, I take it, or, you know, Prairie St. John's is funding it. And the reason I'm falling down this line is that, I mean, if you're going to build something that's going to have 20 beds and it's going to be at capacity from the day you open it up, I mean, that's a pretty big investment. And every time you do a construction project, it's easier to build it a lot larger to begin with. You get the same roof, you just make it a little bigger instead of trying to start over again. Why would you go into put this kind of money into a project if you're going to be at capacity right from the get-go? And can you answer some of those questions for me, please?
Senator Marty, Senator Dahl, it is something that can be achieved rather quickly. We would hope to be up and running before the end of the year. The requirements for building a psychiatric hospital are not the same as the requirements for building a regular general hospital. So things like oxygen lines and vacuum lines run to every room are not necessary. And so it is it's relatively less expensive to do. But we would want to choose a site that had the ability to expand if we were given the opportunity and permission from the legislature to do so at a later date.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Mr. Ryan. Can you tell us how long have you been trying to build a facility in Minnesota? How long have you been working at getting something built that would, I remember last year, I think it was, or maybe it was the year before, you had the larger facility and now this one, but I don't know if there was history before that, but how long has this project been going on for Prairie St. John's?
Senator Marty, Senator Hahn, the project has really started back in 2006 when we came to the Twin Cities noticing that a lot of our patients in Fargo were coming from the Twin Cities. Okay, and when you notice that ambulances are driving 220 miles to drop patients off to find an available bed, you know, there's a significant shortage of resources where they're coming from. And so first expanded our patient resources down here to get a better feel for the need. And our first attempt at actually building an inpatient hospital was our proposal last year.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ryan. Would you know and would you be willing to tell us how much money have you spent to get this project to the place where it is today?
Senator Marty, Senator Hahn, I believe that we've, you know, it's in direct costs. I think that it's probably somewhere around $100,000 to $150,000. But you know, again, that's a wild guess on my part, simply because you know there's probably untold hours of somebody running copies for committee hearings like this. There's you know the hours that I spend, you know, maybe on this, maybe on a different project, maybe two different projects that are working toward the same end. But in terms of direct costs, I think that'd be fairly accurate.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ryan, thank you for that. I guess I was just curious because I support your bill. I did when it was here before, and I guess more recently I've got sort of a personal interest. I have a good friend that I just happened to be with last week, and he has a teenage daughter. He's actually got three daughters, but one of them had some kind of a mental health concern, and they tried to admit her into a local hospital, and they couldn't. And they ended up transporting this girl to Duluth, to your point, Senator Prettner-Solon. And they didn't leave her there very long because it was just impractical for them to be up there camped out in Duluth trying to deal with these circumstances with her daughter. And I just find that it is amazing to me that you've got a group of physicians and people who care about health care for patients, and you want to do something to provide for that, and you spend 3 years and $150,000 to get permission to do that. And I just am mystified by that. So I hope we pass your bill. I think Senator Dahl has a good point. I'm a little concerned that we're getting this because maybe it's your feeling this is the most we could hope for right now, so we'll ask for this and we'll live with it. My guess is that if we didn't have the moratorium, which if I look at this bill, this is now the 24th exception to the idea that we're not going to allow anybody to build any healthcare facilities in Minnesota because we have too much capacity, apparently. I just think that the costs to do this are a complete waste of money. And we ought to let people who have an interest in this and have private investors that are willing to do it, to let them do it. So I'll support your bill. I wish we would, as a legislature, take a more aggressive posture toward this and free this up and get it out of the legislature. It doesn't belong here. Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, my question is along a little bit different line. In conversations that I've had with the folks from Prairie St. John's in regard to this legislation, there was a commitment made that this facility would be providing treatment not only for psychiatric conditions but also chemical dependency conditions. And the language in the bill isn't that clear about it, and so I'd like to have that on the record.
Senator Marty, Senator Berglund, I believe that in our handout that we gave, that there is a there's a statement that we would treat psychiatric conditions and chemical dependency as a secondary diagnosis, that it would not be a primary diagnosis of chemical dependency, but that essentially a dual diagnosis patient would be, I believe, a patient that we would be willing to treat.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess if it's on the record, I'd like a bit, little better than I believe.
Perhaps Dr. Sederberg, the co-founder of Prairie St. John's, could speak to that.
Welcome to the committee.
Chairman Marty, Senator Berglund, I'm Dr. Steve Sederberg from Prairie St. John's. We struggled a bit, Senator, with how to include the language about the chemical dependency piece in the bill. And the difficulty is we will be subject to EMTALA. And so we will have to take whatever emergencies are presenting in the community. So we thought the best way clinically to handle that would be to have on staff therapists that had the capacity to treat the substance abuse issues that present and limit ourselves to the dual diagnosis patients. Otherwise, we could face a situation where, given the demand, it might end up being a 20-bed chemical dependency treatment facility. If we took, all chemical dependency patients, and that's why we thought of limiting to dual diagnosis, we would certainly be open to language clarifying that, but we just didn't come up with any.
Mr. Chairman and Doctor, I am not trying to turn you into a chemical dependency treatment center. My concern was that we'd be treating children with dual diagnosis in one facility. And so if you're making that commitment, that's all I was ever looking for.
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Ms. Abderhogan, are you here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Sue Abderholden. I'm the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I just come from the NAMI board met last month, and I just want to raise just some kind of contextual issues. Last session, you passed language that said that the Department of Human Services would create kind of an intensive services work group to really look at, you know, kind of both before both children and adults come into the hospital and afterwards to see if perhaps there are some ways to divert people out of inpatient hospital beds, which is our, you know, most costly form and most intensive form of care, and are there people who are in hospital beds that could actually get out if we did some other things that were different. That work group, it did finish its work, and my understanding is that the final report is getting ready to be signed off on the various parties within the Department of Human Services. The other thing I want to bring up is that the Department of Human Services in their budget also talks about changing the Wilmer Hospital, the CABS proposal, and doing a whole lot of creating new partial hospitalization programs around the state. What NAMI's concerned about is that all three of these really interconnect. I know just from looking at the one piece of data for kids who are on medical assistance, about 10% of the kids use 46% of the bed days. And, you know, if you just freed up, you know, 10% of those bed days, all of a sudden you have a lot more vacancies and a lot more use of the inpatient hospital beds. When we looked at who are those kids, they're very, very complex kids. They're kids who have, you know, Asperger's and depression and anxiety and aggressive behavior. They're kids who have traumatic brain injury, depression, and usually there's some violent behavior there. And those kids are in there not just for 10 days, or 30 days, they're in there for far longer. And so while I'm not sitting here saying, you know, we're opposed to this proposal, I'm just saying that all of these three things are coming together at the same time. And when we want to use our resources most effectively, we think we should be also be looking at, you know, how are we going to get some of these kids out to free up those inpatient bed days, which, again, are our most expensive days. NAMI has great concerns about the department's proposal as well, because we don't think the state should be the provider of services unless somebody else, you know, won't come to the table. And the increased rates in the partial hospitalization program, I think we will have more people coming to the table. So I just wanted to just raise those issues in terms of we should really be looking at all three of these issues together.
Thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, I should mention, I think I did, that there also will be an increase in partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient services at this facility, too.
Dr. Sederberg, have you made commitments on medical assistance patients or uncompensated care patients? Or?
Yes, in fact, we're eager to become Medicaid eligible. In our current programs in the Twin Cities, we are not Medicaid eligible because we're too far from the base hospital in Fargo to meet CMS standards for facility affiliation. So not only in this new facility would we become Medicaid eligible, but then, you know, a significant number of patients that we treat now for free in our existing programs we would get Medicaid reimbursement for. So frankly, we're incented for that. And as child psychiatrists, especially, I think, among our peers in psychiatry, by virtue of our commitment to children, many of us feel most committed to those children with the greatest needs. And so we could not really have a facility like this in good conscience without taking care of those with Medicaid and the uninsured to the extent that we can.
There are further discussion from members of the committee. Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, I guess I'm following up with Senator Han was saying earlier about the lag and what Senator Prettner-Solon said in her testimony. If their need is there, why is it that no local or metro facilities have stepped forward? Why is it only Prairie St. John's, the one from Fargo, coming down to the Twin Cities to make this proposal? Is there another reason why that's being blocked, why no other facilities or hospitals have stepped forward with this, if there's a need?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, I don't know. We have a moratorium in place. That's you know, difficult to get an exception from it, as you can tell from this proposal having come forward 2 years in a row. So it needs to meet very specific criteria. I'm not sure why. Well, first of all, I know the mental health does not pay well. And often it's a losing proposition. You know, oftentimes it doesn't cover its expenses. So it takes some significant effort and dedication on the part of the parties that are coming forward.
Okay. Senator Berglund and Senator Hahn.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dahl, you know, before you joined the legislature, we had quite a bit of discussion about whether and how many beds would be available for mental health at the facility that is being constructed in Maple Grove. And it was a fight. We couldn't get the beds provided. So I would say that the primary reason that we don't have more providers coming forward is a revenue issue. And the moratorium does not preclude anyone who operates a hospital in Minnesota today from either rearranging their bed capacity, taking beds out of layaway, or coming forward with a moratorium exception request. But we haven't had it happen. And you know, I don't believe it's because of our laws. I believe it's because of the Medicare reimbursement system. Now, the second thing that I had, Mr. Chairman, is there anyone here from the Department of Health?
Welcome to the committee.
Ms. Sonier, I guess the question that I have relates to the process that's established in law for the department to evaluate a proposal prior to it coming to the legislature. And again, I'm just asking for this to be on the record so that in the future we would understand this particular proposal better. I believe that in the past you evaluated the proposal that was here last year. It came to the Department of Health. And would you consider that evaluation and your response to the proposal to be adequate to cover this more narrow proposal?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, for the record, I'm Julie Sonier from the Minnesota Department of Health. We did do an evaluation last year of a 144-bed hospital that was proposed for Woodbury. And the department at that time recommended that the proposal was not in the public interest.
Between the Maple Grove proposal and the Woodbury proposal, would you consider the issues that are raised in this legislation to have been addressed in one or the other?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, certainly some of the concerns that the department raised have been addressed. We don't have enough information to know fully whether all of them have been addressed, and we don't know, having not been asked to do a review at this time, we don't know if there are any remaining other stakeholder concerns.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sonier, I know that you have not been asked to do another formal review, but I guess I would believe that based on what has been done in the two other proposals that I've cited, that you would be able to draw some conclusions about whether or not there would be a need for this size and type of facility. And that's all I'm looking for, because in the future, if somebody wants to come directly to the legislature, I think it is important that we have some opinion from the Department of Health in this regard.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we have not done an analysis of how many beds are needed. Last year, our concern was that the number that was being proposed was too large. We certainly did identify some problems with people traveling long distances to receive care, and so the addition of some beds would address some of the existing problems.
Well, I guess I can ask the question, Mr. Chairman, another way. If the Maple Grove Hospital proposal would have had 20 mental health beds included in it, would you have considered it inappropriate?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I can't say that conclusively. It's difficult to take a position today on whether the proposal, given the fact that there's a possibility if we were ever asked to evaluate it and we had more information, we might come to a different conclusion. So that's why I hesitate. I want to be able to not have taken a position on something and then be later asked to be a neutral party evaluating it. Based on the facts that we have before us today, I would say that the department would not at this time say that the proposal is not in the public interest.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if Ms. Abderholden would be willing to come back and answer a question. And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Abderholden, thank you for coming back. I just wanted to be clear on our little agenda list here. You're listed as Representative Nami in opposition to the bill, and your remarks were not clear to me, and I guess I just would like to be clear for the record whether you, as representing your organization, oppose this bill or whether you support it. Could you clarify that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, it's neither. We have concerns. NAMI has really tried to look at, how do we create a full children's mental health system, so that we keep kids from going into the hospital, that if they're in there, that they come out. So we really look at the whole thing. So it's hard to pull out one piece. And I think that it is fair to say that we'd love to see the report come out. We'd love to talk about the CAMHS proposal as a part of this. There's another piece in the governor's budget as well in terms of making the crisis teams more flexible for kids, because right now we don't have crisis teams in every county in the state for children. So there are some pieces there that I think are important as a piece of this. I will say that we're glad that it's not as large a proposal as had been proposed, because we really felt that was far too institutional. So this is certainly much better in terms of coming down in bed size. We really do understand the kind of trickiness of all of this. I've had a daughter who's been hospitalized for mental health issues, so I know all too well about sitting in an emergency room and then finding a placement and, all of that kind of thing. So it's not for lack of understanding families' concerns. It's really trying to look at, knowing we have limited resources, how do we make sure that we are serving the kids in the best way, the most effective way, and frankly, not the most expensive way.
Thank you. Further discussion? If not, Senator Prettner-Solin, move Senate file 615 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Oh, sorry.
Torres Ray, Senate File 473.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. I'm going to wait a couple of minutes until we have some people leaving. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 473. I have studied this issue very carefully, and I'm hoping that I am prepared to respond to some of the questions you may have about the cost associated with this bill, which I know is in the minds of all members today as we come before you asking for funding to fund these particular proposals. One of the reasons I decided to move forward with this in these difficult times really has to do with the finance formula of this particular bill. And in the presentations, you will have an opportunity to ask more questions and to hear more about this. But what we know right now is that failing to detect and treat risk factors related to this issue is very costly. The Office of Economic Status of Women estimates that without preventing efforts, the state is likely to spend $405 million. Because heart disease and stroke and other cardiovascular diseases are the leading cause of death for Minnesota women. From research, we know that over 5,000 Minnesota women die each year due to heart disease or stroke. 80% of heart disease is preventable through early detection and management of risk factors. Mr. Chairman and members, that is the reason I am coming before you to ask for your support. We have done extensive work in this area, and we feel very strongly that we are bringing a proposal before you that will save the state thousands of dollars and that will save many lives. With me, I have Dr. Mary Boylan today and Ms. Natasha Fleshman, who will present to you some statements related to these issues. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Natasha Fleshman from Lake Elmo, and I was 33 when I died. That morning, I had gotten up, put my kindergartner on the bus to go to school, took my preschooler to the YMCA, where I worked out as I normally did. We got home from there, and I dropped the boys off at the babysitter, and I went to a meeting at the St. Paul School District office, just a few short blocks from here. I was a coordinator for the English language department there. I had a meeting, and it was at that meeting that my heart stopped. Someone was called in to do bystander CPR on me. St. Paul Fire was called, and they had to defibrillate my heart 5 times to get it restarted. From there, they rushed me to Regents Hospital, and no one thought I would make it through the day, or that if I did, that I would be fully coherent following that day. I worked out regularly. I ate tofu and whole grains and lots of vegetables. I was not someone that you typically think of is going to die of heart disease at such a young age, but I nearly did. And my story proves that heart disease can strike anyone. And this is why the Women's Heart Health Promotion Act is so important to me. We know that more women than men die of heart disease each year, and we know that the rate of women who die that are African American or Hispanic is far higher than that for other populations. If we screen low-income women now for heart disease, we can help reduce the number of deaths and reduce treatment costs by finding the problem early while it's easier and less expensive to treat. 7 years ago, we thought that I would die or need a heart transplant. With medications and a trusty implanted defibrillator, I have regained normal heart function. I am now a volunteer for Women Heart, the National Coalition of Women with Heart Disease, and I work to educate women about their risk of heart disease. I'm back working in adult basic education, a job that I love, and not only do I get to continue to pay taxes, but I'm working every day getting more Minnesotans back to work in that job. And in addition, I'm also doing the best I can to get my now 5th and 8th grader through their teen and preteen years, and if anything requires a strong heart, it's that. And then 2 years ago, I was elected to the Stillwater Area Schools School Board. When you save the life of a woman, her impact can be great, and the ripple effects go throughout the community at large. We need to do what we can to help more women survive heart disease so that they, too, can continue and not shorten their legacies. Thank you.
Thank you very much for telling your story.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Dr. Mary Boylan. I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon at St. Luke's Hospital in Duluth, Minnesota. And I see patients who are at the end of the ropes. These are patients who've had cardiovascular heart disease diagnosed, maybe treated with medications, maybe treated with stents, and when those things fail, they end up in my operating room. Cardiovascular disease is the number one cause of death in this country and has been for decades. The fact that most Americans don't know is that more women than men die of heart disease. The bigger fact is that that's not new news. That's been going on for 25 years. And that is going on not only around the country, it's going on right here in Minnesota. Every year, 5,000 women here in Minnesota die from some form of cardiac or vascular disease. The only treatment that is truly effective for cardiovascular disease is prevention. Prevention is cheap, it's easy, but prevention can't occur if a woman is not identified as having cardiovascular risk factors. When we think about it, you know, I suspect everyone in this room is pretty savvy, and I suspect a lot of us actually know that more women than men die of cardiovascular disease. And we're lucky, we're fortunate, we're educated. The women who are at the greatest risk are those who aren't so fortunate, who don't have the luxury of the education, who don't have the luxury of routine annual physical exams. And these are the women that we're talking about. And this is why the Women's Heart Health Program is so important. When we think about cardiovascular disease, every year 5,000 women die. That's 14 women every day here in Minnesota who succumb to cardiovascular disease. We know that prevention works. We know it works from studies that have been done around the country, from a study that we did in Duluth, Minnesota, where we identified women, and we didn't do anything fancy, we didn't do anything expensive. We did routine basic testing, assessing for risk factors. I suspect a lot of us know what those risk factors are. Diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, inactivity, obesity, cigarette smoking or exposure. Women who are underinsured or uninsured don't have the luxury of getting those routine physical exams and that routine testing. The impact is that these women don't have the opportunity for prevention. Prevention truly is the treatment for cardiovascular disease. What does prevention mean? It doesn't mean anything fancy or expensive. It really means things that are simple. It means the simple choice between a bag of potato chips or fresh fruit. It doesn't mean joining a gym or any expensive athletic club. It means knowing to make the decision to choose to walk. When we think about the women who are the most vulnerable, there truly is a disparity in our community and around the country. Who are the women who are most vulnerable? It truly is the minorities. Women who are of African-American descent, American Indians, Hispanic, they have higher rates of all these risk factors. They have less knowledge about these risk factors and therefore less opportunity for intervention. I have a pass out, which is actually a couple of the diagrams or the charts that were produced from the Minnesota Department of Health in their recent booklet about Minnesota Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention Plan for 2004 to 2010. And I think these diagrams will show and just reiterate what I've mentioned. Thank you. That cardiovascular disease is the number one cause of death, and it truly is the number one cause of death for women. And I would suggest you look around, because one out of every 2 to 3 women in this room will succumb to cardiovascular disease. We have the opportunity for prevention. What this bill suggests and promotes is that we actually spend money on prevention. Prevention isn't quite as much of a headliner as a new PET scan machine, but it's going to be by far more effective, and it's going to be, in the end, far less expensive for our city and for our towns and for our community and for the state. So I'd ask you to support the Women's Heart Health Program bill so that we give these women who are at the greatest risk, the under- and uninsured women, many of whom are minorities, an opportunity for better cardiovascular health. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Senator Erickson Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Torres-Ray, thank you very much for bringing this bill. I'm a strong supporter of your bill and prevention in general. My question is, has any research been done at all about the economic impact on families who lose their mothers? I think this is really key. Having lived some of that in my life, or by proxy, my mother lost her mother early in life, and there were 3 young elementary children raised on a farm, and it really plunged their father and their family into poverty for many, many years because of the extra work needed to be hired done by by the absence of the mother and other factors. So do you have any information on economic data?
I think what the information that I can offer you is somewhat more limited, and that's I think you bring up a very important point. Whether the family is headed by simply a mother or whether it's a family with both parents, the cost for treating a woman who develops cardiovascular disease far outweighs the cost of prevention. In St. Louis County, we have a high percentage of families headed by just a woman. And these are clearly the greatest at-risk group. And if you take that woman who is at the lowest socioeconomic part of the community and now make her unable to work because she hasn't had the opportunity for prevention, I don't have a dollar figure, but you know, I don't think I'd be out on a limb to say that would be much more costly to us as a community than identifying our risk factors and getting some prevention done. We can talk about the benefits of preventing women from developing heart disease among the 15,000 who would be treated by this bill. We know that it sounds like a lot of money to spend $750,000 a year to identify risk factors in 15,000 women. But I can tell you if, less than 20 of those women went on to develop heart disease, the cost would be over $400 million to treat them. And that doesn't even look at the employment implications.
And I know one of the groups I'm involved with is the Sudden Cardiac Arrest Association of Minnesota, and we work to get automated external defibrillators in more public places to save lives. And we're working on collecting that data because with every life you save, you know, I've already been paying taxes for 7 years, and I think I have a good 40 years ahead of me. And so that adds up a lot. And I know Women Heart, the National Coalition of Women with Heart Disease, has worked on collecting that data, and at minimum they have a lot of anecdotal data. And I would love to go back and try to dig some up for you if I can, because I do think that is valuable information.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, one thing I neglected to explain that I think it is a useful piece of information is that this particular program will be connected to the SAGE program. What that means is that when you look at $750,000 and really what we will do with this money, all of these will be going to testing. Right now we receive about $4.5 million from the federal government, $1.2 million from the state government, and $1 million from private funding for the SAGE program. So this money that we're asking for will not be to create an additional program, but rather to get 15,000 women screened, and that is only $25 additional dollars for the screening, and then the follow-up counseling so that these women can go into the programs and do the exercise or the dieting that they need. So it's a very cost-effective program because we are connecting it, proposal because we're connecting it to an existing program.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray. First, I wanted to just acknowledge this handout that we got, the burden of cardiovascular disease in Minnesota, because one of the questions that I had was, how, if any, in any way, was your bill related to Minnesota's heart disease and stroke prevention plan? And I see clearly that there is a correlation here, and that's good. I think it's good to note for the committee that the Minnesota's heart disease and stroke prevention plan is from 2004 to 2010. It's 2009. So part of our challenge here is, so often that it's not that we don't know, we don't recognize, we don't realize, we don't, you know, we know how to address the situation. But clearly, as these plans are put together by the department, oftentimes in cooperation or at the urging of the legislature, we have a preponderance to put our plans on the shelf. So I just wanted to remind us all, this goes back to work that began years ago. And so thank you for continuing to tell the story, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. And Mr. Chairman and Senators, it is precisely Senator Lynch because of that that I decided that we really need to hear this proposal, and I wanted to really strongly advocate for it. The reality is that we really need to invest in reforms. As you know, we're spending a lot of money in healthcare right now, and we spend very little money in prevention. When you really look at the total cost right now, as it is stated in this research that we just provided you, it costs $405 million to treat only 15 women. It is very expensive to treat women that have this disease. So prevention is a very cost-effective solution, and that is the reason I am asking for your support.
Senator Torres-Ray moves Senate File 473. Be recommended pass and referred to Committee on Finance. Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe this is a question that you might be able to answer. How are we proposing to pay for this appropriation that the bill calls for? I am troubled by this, and I've been in other committees reluctant to adopt bills that require appropriation when we don't have any idea yet of how this budget is going to be solved, and it's not as if we've got extra dollars out there. So is there any thought here? Are we going to be cutting back on something even more than what we have to do this, or what is the plan? Can you respond to that?
Senator Hand, my personal preference would be we do more of this and spend less money at the heart surgery end. These issues will be resolved in the Finance Committee, and it's got a tough road there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and I know this is a policy committee, but given that we don't yet as a legislature have any idea of what the overall approach to this, I'm very reluctant to vote for additional appropriations until I know what I'm going to have to be giving up to get that. And it's not that I disagree with the program or the intent of the bill. I think it sounds very good, and I would support it. But I'm not, at this point, willing to ask for additional appropriation until we have an understanding of what we're going to do. So I just don't know how we can pass this without knowing that.
On Senator Torres-Ray's motion, any more discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. Senator Lynch, Senate File 986.
I am here with Senate File 986, and Mr. Chair, I have the A4 amendment, an author's amendment to put the bill in proper form.
Senator Lynch moves the A4, delete everything, an author's amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I have a technical amendment to the A4. I don't know if it would be appropriate to make that notation at this point in time, with your indulgence. On line 2.8, and this is of the A4 amendment that was just adopted, on 2.8, if you would delete after the comma, chapter 2960. That would be the end of line 2.8. So I would delete the comma or Minnesota rules, comma parts. And on 2.9, continuing on line 2.9, delete everything up to the word provided. That's a statutory reference that is not necessary.
Up to the comma, you'd want to delete it there.
Actually, I believe it'd be through the comma.
Okay, you're leaving the other comma. I thought you said you were striking. Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, did we leave on 2.8 under Minnesota rules, comma, and then no no number after it, or did I just miss that?
We deleted the rules, the rule parts. We just left chapter 2960.
Oh, we left the chapter. Got it. I'm sorry. Okay, I vote aye.
Good.
A little after the fact. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to begin with just saying that the bill before you tonight is the result of some work that was done with a work group that met during the fall and into the earlier parts of session. And I want to thank and acknowledge Senator Berglund. I approached her on this concept and had her support and encouragement to pull together a work group that consisted of myself, Senator Sharon, Lori, and Rosen. And with that work group, we invited various stakeholders and interest groups, many of who are assembled in this room with us tonight, to provide some input to us and some counsel and guidance to us as we were approaching this session with the recognition that these would be some very challenging budget times. And we posed the question to them, what might we be able to do in terms of mandate reduction and flexibility that might ease some of the burden on your organizations and within your stakeholder groups. And so we received many, many suggestions along the way. Before I get into the nuts and bolts of the bill, I want to just say something that we reiterated each and every time the work group met. And that is, these were really interesting and sometimes difficult conversations to have. And I would just suggest to members and to those listening that what appears before you tonight is a reflection of the time that we are in and the position that we are in. And given another period of time and given different financial situation, perhaps some of these ideas would not have been formulated or would not have progressed along. But the simple fact is the work group was committed to trying to afford some flexibility to Minnesotans and trying to create some flexibility. And so with that, I'll walk you through the various sections of the bill. And, Mr. Chair, what I thought we would do is, because the nature of the bill, there are so many different aspects of this one bill, that we'll go through each section, and then if members have questions on particular sections, we can take those. So to begin with, Article 1, Sections 1, 2, 5, and 6. These sections allow counties to place children with severe emotional disturbances in residential facilities in bordering states. Again, all of these provisions before you tonight are being brought forward in the name of flexibility. Section 2 and 5 were deleted in the author's amendment. Section 3 requires a level of care determination for children admitted to a treatment foster care setting. Currently, the existing law is that this must be done within 3 days. This amends that to provide some flexibility to occur within 5 days. Section 4 and 10 allow cremation in lieu of burial for recipients of public assistance and eliminate required provisions of funeral services. Section 7 eliminates the Children's Mental Health Collaborative anti-supplantation provisions. Section 8 clarifies that either the caseworker or the licensor may make the mandatory monthly visit to a child in foster care, again seeking some additional flexibility. And Section 9 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to revise rules related to relative foster parents, doing this without jeopardizing the safety of the child and echoing what is allowed and required under federal law. Then we go on to Article 2. Article 2, Section 1, requires the Commissioner of Health to accept an independent audit on a health plan company. Section 2 and Section 3 are revised in the author's amendment, so we'll deal with those when we get to the amendment. Section 4 deletes the requirement for periodic nursing supervision of Class B home care aides. Section 5 requires the Department of Human Services to accept accreditation by the Commission on Rehabilitation Facilities as equivalent to state licensure. Section 6 relieves school districts and charter schools of the responsibility to provide health care information and assistance to students and families, requires that that information be provided on the school's website. Section 7 removes the requirement that a renewal notice be sent to a state health care program enrollee 90 days prior to the renewal, removes the requirement that managed care plans provide a follow-up renewal call. Section 8 allows providers of assisted living services under the MA Elderly Waiver Program to provide nighttime supervision using personnel who have other duties and are located in adjoining buildings if certain conditions are met. Section 9 is intended to clarify what is current practice. Has to do with public employers providing health benefits for their employees through negotiated contributions to self-funded multi-employer health and welfare plans. Section 10 is deleted. And walking through the four amended, as it was amended, Section 1 exempts the Department of Health food, beverage, and lodging establishment licensure requirements for group residential facilities that are also licensed by the Department of Human Services. Section 2 modifies day treatment services under the Children's Mental Health Act by allowing a minimum two-hour block time instead of a minimum three-hour block time for day treatment services and up to 15 hours instead of 5 days per week. Sections 6 to 8. Section 6 to 8 is looking a little fuzzy to me at this moment. amends the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports. We'll have someone offer some further clarification on that. In fact, I think it might be best at this particular junction if I defer to Ms. Regan and ask her to assist.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. Section 6 is eliminating the local certification requirement for children's therapeutic services and supports. Right now, there are two ways that each one of these providers need to get certified. One is the state has a very comprehensive certification. And then they also direct each provider to get a local certification from each county in which they're going to work. And I think the original idea behind that made some sense, but both the department and the providers in discussions over the last few months have agreed that that's duplicative and doesn't add any value to the process. Next, a pretty technical, just clarifying that the provider does not need to submit their policies every 3 years to the department, does not need to update them, but only needs to do that as necessary. And then section, further down in that section, section 7, further down in subdivision 4B, so page 5 of the amendment, line 5.13, eliminates the requirement that there be on-site observation during the first 12 hours of a mental health practitioner providing a skills service to a family. That, again, is something both the department and providers decided was unnecessary and too costly for supervisors to go out to the home and observe. It does clarify that if the mental health professional believes it's the right thing to do and is a good part of good clinical supervision, that when it is done, it needs to be done according to the original plan, which is for a minimum of one clinical unit.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I believe that brings us to Article 2. And Article 2, 3 are suggestions by the Health Department regarding incontinent nursing home residents and repositioning of residents. This language treats all nursing homes equally by applying the standards to all homes regardless of whether they are certified. Members, I know that that's a lot of information. There's been a lot of that's went into this. And it's my hope that if you have questions on particular sections, there are good resources in the room to aid us further in the discussion. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, can you explain to me a little bit further on page 2 about where this is coming from on this cremation and funeral expenses payment made by a county agency? Can you explain that and what this changes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson from MICA. Bill to Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Members, Section 2 and Section 10 have been a long time initiative of counties to reduce our costs for the disposition of the remains of the indigent. Right now, under current law, we are required to provide burial for those individuals and funeral services. I think, as probably many of you know in personal experience or experiences that you're seeing out in the community, cremation is becoming more and more the frequent option for disposition of the remains of the deceased. I believe about 40% of dispositions of remains is now done by cremation rather than by burial. And basically, we're looking for the same option for counties for their expenses for disposition of the remains of indigents when it is not contravening the religious or moral beliefs of the next of kin or the spouse. So basically, this is a cost-saving provisions for the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Carlson, so what organization are you with? Intercounty? What?
Minnesota Intercounty Association.
And can you explain that to me? What is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the Minnesota Intercounty Association consists of 13 of the counties in the state, 5 here in the Twin City metropolitan area, and 8 in greater Minnesota, mostly the larger counties or growing counties in the greater Minnesota area.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is 87 counties in the state. I certainly am a little bit troubled when 13 of the largest counties are dictating to the other counties, because this is going to affect the other counties. And I have a problem with this when we're saying that this is a cost savings when you're talking about somebody losing their loved one, number one, and we're talking about saving money. I don't think that we should be going there.
Ms. Caldwell,
I'm just a little bit, Mr. Chairman. I'm really troubled by this, Senator Lynch. Last year I actually carried the recodification and the redoing of 149A, which is the funeral statute, and so I'm going to move to take this out unless somebody can give me a better reason to keep it in. At this time, and then I'd be willing to talk to you about it later on. But just because
The state has 40% cremation. That doesn't mean that we need to start cremating everybody. This is the first time I've seen this, so I can't get my thoughts in order to respond to this. But I think this is something that I think people will be very worried about. I really do. And so I'm going to make a motion after I hear from Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cornyn, just very briefly, and then you'll have an opportunity to hear from Patricia Caldwell, who represents the Association of Minnesota Counties. But I just wanted to clarify for members that perhaps as much or more, quite honestly, than any of the stakeholders assembled here tonight, the work group worked with and heard from both MICA and AMC on a good number of issues that appear before you tonight. And I really, I never sensed that at any point in the discussion were any particular groups of counties given more credence or attention or stronger voice than any other. But Mr. Chair, I'd like to yield to Ms. Caldwell.
Ms. Caldwell.
Mr. Chair, members, Patricia Caldwell, Association of Minnesota Counties, and Senator Coring, just wanted to mention that this particular provision was initiated by MICA, but this is one that AMC fully supports as well, and our members are also interested in just having more flexibility in how we use the limited resources that are going to be available to us. And I also did want to stress again on Mr. Carlson's point that if there are moral or religious reasons that a family would not support cremation, then they would move to a burial.
And Mr. Chairman, I know a little bit of how it works. You know, the caseworker is the person that decides if I'm correct. The caseworker will decide whether or not a person is going to be cremated or is going to have a traditional burial. And, you know, just because somebody's poor or doesn't have enough money to pay for their funeral services to kind of start herding people in the direction of saying, no, you have to be cremated, I just think that's a pretty sad state of affairs myself. And so I would, Mr. Chairman, I would move to delete Section 4 and Section 10 out of the bill.
On that,
and I would ask for a roll call vote on that, too.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, my good friend, and members of the committee. You know, oftentimes there is no next of kin. That's one of the reasons that the county is left with the responsibility of helping this person be buried or cremated. And so if there is a preference on the part of the family, they will honor the preference. But if the family doesn't have a preference, or if there is no family or next of kin, then why should we assume that burial is the proper way to proceed rather than cremation?
Senator Lynch, then Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if Commissioner Sivaraja, I believe from Anoka, has joined me, and perhaps the members would like to hear from her before they take the vote.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Marty and members of the committee. Certainly, Senator Berglund is correct in that the caseworker does not determine whether the person would go for a regular burial or cremation. That decision would be left up to the family. I was a financial worker for 12 years before I became a county commissioner and administered these programs, and that certainly was an option for families. Currently in Anoka County, over 50% of our families are choosing that. And again, it's a choice, and we're just asking for flexibility within the statute for that to be available to all counties.
Commissioner, could you give your name for the record?
Sure. Rhonda Sivaraja.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, if it's an option now, then why do we need this language then?
Senator Coring, it depends what's the assumption, what the default would be. Senator Hahn and then Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Senator Lynch, one of your witnesses, can answer this. But as I'm reading this, what I'm getting from it is that right now the law says that you pay for a funeral, which I read to mean having the service and a burial, and what you're doing instead is saying that we shall pay for a cremation and only a funeral under the circumstances where for religious or other reasons that's what is requested. Is there any financial data that you have? I mean, how much money would this save? Do we know? Do we have anything that would give us some idea of what this would result in terms of savings to the public if you went this way rather than the current law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I was attempting to ascertain that with the Department of Human Services this afternoon and unfortunately was unable to connect on two separate occasions with the individual who has that information, but I will happily provide that information as soon as I get it. With regards to the funeral, I guess I'll just relate my personal experience. I just went through the death of my father-in-law, who's had a traditional funeral, traditional burial. With regards to my late mother, we elected to cremate her. And we made all the arrangements for the memorial service themselves. That is an option that, frankly, is available to anybody. Why the taxpayers should bear the cost of having the funeral service director be the usher at the funeral, do the arrangement at the front of the hall or place of worship, frankly, is beyond me in these times when we're looking for any savings that we can find.
Any further discussion? Senator Hahn, did you?
Mr. Chairman, I guess just to my friend Senator Coring's motion, I'm just wondering if you, I mean, maybe this would be something that could be brought up in the Finance Committee after the numbers are known. I'm concerned, I guess, that if you've got a significant number of folks that may not have next of kin, but we're going through a full burial and the cost to do that, and I don't know what those costs are, but if it's significant, it seems to me it might be a better option to say let's do a lower cost option if that's a significant piece of what we're doing. But I don't know that, and it doesn't look like we're going to have that information today, and so maybe rather than having the motion to take this out, leave it in until we get to finance and perhaps have that discussion and a little more data brought forward at that point. Because just intuitively, it seems like what the bill is as it's written would make sense. But I appreciate your concerns. And
is there anybody else that wants to?
Yeah, there is. We will have a witness from the Funeral Association if they want to come forward. In the meantime, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I just, again, based on personal experience, want to share the difference between a cremation and a funeral. It cost over $7,000 to bury, have traditional funeral services for my father-in-law. For my mother-in-law, it cost $1,000 for the cremation. Although I cannot provide the aggregate savings, it's obvious, I think, from those examples, which I think everybody knows, the amount of savings that would be accrue to the taxpayer by the passage of this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Jorgensen with the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, and we do have some concerns as well, but we would be happy to work with the authors on the wording going forward.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Well, let me say one other thing. You know, Mr. Carlson makes it sound like the county pays $7,000 per funeral. They do not pay $7,000. If I'm not mistaken, I think Hennepin County pays, I think it's $2,500 or $2,000 or $2,500, but they do not pay $7,000 for a traditional burial. You know, so to think that they're paying that much, they're not. They pay a certain amount, and that's it. And, you know, another thing, too, is, you know, I think in here I thought I read that you're not paying for transportation anymore. What if somebody has passed away down here and needs to get back up to Brainerd and the family can't afford to pay for it?
I don't know. I just, where is this bill going to go after we're done with it here?
This bill will be going to the Finance Committee. I'm not sure if there are any other stops.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to leave my motion stand, and if I fail here, then I'll just continue on as long as the bill is flowing through, and if I can't make it here, then I'll continue on. So is that all right?
That's fine. And did you request a roll call?
I did.
Any further discussion on that motion? If not, Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Berglund.
No.
Senator Dahl.
Not here.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
No.
Senator Fischbach. Senator Hahn.
I'm going to pass.
Senator Higgins.
No.
Senator Johnson. Senator Coring.
Aye.
Senator Lurie. Senator Lynch.
No.
Senator Prittner Solon. Senator Torres Ray.
No.
By a vote of 1 in favor and 7 opposed, the motion does not prevail. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I've been trying to work through the amendment changes, and I'm finding a couple of places where I think it doesn't say what we should say. And I'll call your attention to 3.4 on the amendment, which amends line 26 on page 1. And it says to delete the words "which includes" and insert "may include," but I sure can't make that sentence make any sense. And I think what it should say is that in services must be appropriate to the child's age and treatment needs and must be made available as close to the county as possible. That includes residential treatment services provided in bordering states, and I'm not sure that's right either. But if somebody can tell us what it's supposed to say, because I think what it says isn't what it's supposed to say. And then I have a couple more places that are kind of like this.
Senate Counsel.
Madam Chair, members, please delete on line 3.4, it should say which may include residential treatment services provided.
That may include. Delete the comma and put that may include to be grammatically correct.
So Senator Higgins moves on line to delete the amendment on line 3.4 of the amendment and instead on line 1.26,
no,
or you want to do it through the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think delete which includes and insert that may include.
On
and delete the
line.
Comma before the which. It now becomes a that.
Delete the comma.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I think we've got the same problem on line 3.30. The facility is the closest facility to the child's home, comma, providing the appropriate level of care. And so I would move to delete the comma and the word providing and say that provides.
Page 3, line 30.
Yes.
To read the child's home, that provides the appropriate. That motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Erickson-Rhodes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lynch, I have a question on in the A4 amendment, page 9, having to do with incontinent patients and resident positioning. And the question is related to comprehensive assessment. It seems that, and I understand you're moving away from a time-specific direction to probably something more individualized, or if somebody doesn't have to be taken to the bathroom or offered that sort of services every 2 hours is usually kind of a standard. If 4 hours is fine, or just checking in with a patient, is that what you're moving towards there? And so is comprehensive assessment defined somewhere? And then could you explain what that does?
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with the Care Providers of Minnesota testifying on behalf of the imperative. The language that's in the proposal seeks to move from a state-based to a federal-based. And the reasoning is this. The Minnesota Nursing Home Rules currently contain two sentences covering the timing of resident toileting and repositioning. In contrast, the federal regulations for facilities that participate in the Medicare program, which is where we're getting this language from, contain over 50 pages of requirements and survey guidance regarding assessing and individualizing the incontinence protocol. So what the proposal does is it allows those facilities which are Medicare certified, therefore they'll be following the federal guidelines that are surveyed every year, to be exempt from the Minnesota requirement and thereby changing it. There will still be some facilities in Minnesota that will be subject to the Minnesota rule, and those would be the ones that are not Medicare certified.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, so what you're saying is I understand the difference between the federal and state requirements, but is a comprehensive assessment more of a patient-centered, individualized approach as opposed to a standardized care plan? I'm seeing heads nod.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, I have a question about Subdivision 12, Section 3, on page 9, the resident positioning. I'm just curious about how prescriptive this language actually is, and if that is something that we need in statute. It's very prescriptive. It just says a lot about what the nursing home should be doing, and I wonder if we need all of that language in statute. And if we do, I would like to know why.
Senator Torres-Ray, or Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, we want to make sure it was hard for us to hear you. I think you're talking about, of the bill, page 9.
That's
lines
correct.
Lines 9.1 to 9.10?
9.1 to 10, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, I think the concern there is that the resident positioning requirements, again, will be similar to what the federal requirements for Medicaid are, or Medicare are, and therefore we're trying to make them similar in statute. They're more restrictive than the Minnesota requirements are currently, in that for Medicare you're surveyed every year, whereas for the state of Minnesota it's every 2 years. So what we're trying to say is that rather than having the duplicative reporting requirements to both Medicare as well as the state, that by using the more patient-centered focus, you get a higher standard, but you also get reporting requirements that will comply for each. And again, this would apply to the Medicare certified, so there will be only to Medicare certified, so there will still be some Minnesota homes that would have to comply with the Minnesota regulations as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Lynch, just a question kind of related to our discussion about the cremation versus funeral services. Has there been I don't know if a fiscal note is appropriate, since these are expenses that are essentially going to the counties, but cost savings for these reductions or eliminations of mandates, any idea what this should result in? Has anybody done anything on that?
Senator Marty and Senator Hand, good question. There was a concerted effort to focus on things that would provide flexibility to our stakeholders, to counties, to providers, to different communities. I would be the first to say that it was much to Senator Berglund's. She would have probably preferred to see a heavy bill come through that would be walloped with cost savings to the state of Minnesota. This is not that bill. This bill is for the people that we serve. This bill is to send that flexibility down to the people that work on the ground in the front lines. And so while I wish that I were sitting here tonight with silver bullet for Senator Berglund and could say that, you know, I was really excited to bring this to her division, this is not the bill that does that.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Lynch, I appreciate that. I guess I was just trying to get a feel for whether there's a thought that this would be cost neutral, have cost impact one way or the other. I mean, any thought on that?
Senator Marty, Senator Hand, I am hopeful that this bill, in terms of the state budget, will be cost neutral. I have in my conversations with MICA and AMC, the health plans, anybody who has a stake in this, I would have encouraged them and expect them to communicate back to the work group as to the success of any of the measures in here. I think we're very interested to hear from them. As you know, it's easy on the front end to throw all these ideas out there, but we will be interested in hearing from them about the impact that some of these decisions have made. Do I think it's going to provide the counties, for example, a windfall? No, I don't. But what I do think is it's going to give them, I think it has given them some encouragement and some hope. I think that it has sent a very strong message that we, as a body, understand, have some empathy for what they're going through. And as we sit here and think about what we can do within our jurisdiction, there are relatively few things that we can do short of writing that check, giving that appropriation. And so I hope that and believe that they will see this and will take this and carry it forward in that light.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lynch, I was listening to Senator Erickson Ropes and Senator Torres Ray's questions about the two resident positioning articles. Are those both in the bill that we're working on here? I mean, they're both 144A.04 subdivision 12 now. And they're different. I mean, they're both on page 9 of both the original bill and the amendment. The original one doesn't seem to be struck. I mean, I'm just trying to, technically, what is it that's in the bill right now?
Senate Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, we are on the A4 amendment, page 9, line 16. We're deleting the old sections 2 and 3 and replacing them with the new sections 2 and 3 on incontinent residents and resident positions.
Okay. So when Senator Torres Ray asked her question about the details on page 9 of the original bill, those are no longer in the bill that we're discussing.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Lynch. Senator Lynch, on page 3 of the amendment, top line, I was curious, are you requiring any day treatment service at all? It says must be available up to 15 hours, which sounds like it means 0 to 15 hours. I assume you want some limit, but did you mean at least 15 hours? Or?
Mr. Chair, I'll yield to Ms. Regan.
Senator Marty and committee members, this is really just allowing a day treatment program to have some flexibility in there, what they provide to kids based on the needs of the child. Right now, there's a requirement that it be 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and that isn't necessarily what each child needs at the whole point of time during their treatment. So there are transitions in and out. There are different times during the year when the needs shift for a child. This just allows that program to provide more flexibility. If they're provided no treatment at all, it wouldn't be day treatment.
So the minimum would effectively be 2 hours because you have a block of 2 hours?
That's correct.
It might be clearer if you just said if you went no more than 15 hours. But I don't know what your intent is on that. I'm just saying it's very awkward wording and it's not clear.
You can get authorization. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if this helps or not, but currently, as I understand it, the maximum is 15 hours a week, and we were just trying to provide some flexibility. I think the example that was given to me was the child is not necessarily in school on those 5 days.
I it just seems awkward wording. It seems you wouldn't even need those words because up to 15 means zero, and if they're not going to provide more than 15, you could just strike the whole clause and just must be available to a child throughout the year.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Senator Conklin has a...
It's okay.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 3, line 1, delete the new language, and on page 3, line 2, delete a week. So the sentence would read, a day treatment service must be available to a child throughout the year.
Senator Lynch moves that. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Ms. Holste, you wanted to speak with some concerns about the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Heidi Holste. I represent AARP of Minnesota as well as the Seniors and Workers Quality Coalition. I'm only commenting on one section, and that is Section 8. We have had meetings with the providers, and we hope to come to some sort of conclusion, but I didn't want to let this opportunity go by this evening. So it seems that this section is about two different issues. One, it is a payment issue. Let me be on record as saying that we do support additional payment going into any type of long-term care setting. The other issue is the concern that we have, and that is about adequate supervision of vulnerable people. We have a few concerns specific to that. First and foremost, DHS policy states that 24-hour customized living under the elderly waiver currently requires on-site supervision. We feel that if a person is determined in need of 24-hour supervision, that they get this level of care.
Mr. Chairman and to members, just to direct you, we're on page 12 of the bill. This is Section 8 in Article 2.
Another issue, another concern that we have, Mr. Chair and members, is that if you allow the staff from the attached or nearby facility to come to leave that facility to come to the attached facility, you're taking staff from one area, putting to another. In these type of situations, the unexpected will happen and can happen, and we just want to make sure that if a person is determined in need of 24-hour level of care, that they get that level of care. And again, just to reiterate that we have been meeting with the providers, and we do hope to continue having those discussions as we move forward. Thank you.
So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm here. I represent Aging Services of Minnesota, but also appearing here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I just want to speak and respond very briefly to Ms. Holste's concerns, and I want to assure the committee that, yes, we are meeting with both Ms. AARP and the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition, as well as the department, to try to work out some language that all the concerns can be addressed. I also do want to give a little bit of background on this provision, where this came from. There are providers, small rural providers, that have contacted us that, in the interest of trying to expand access to services outside the care center, have tried to provide assisted living services. These are oftentimes those that are attached to either a nursing home or a hospital. And the provision is crafted to for providers that are offering 12 or fewer units of assisted living. Under current payment policy and under current rate setting policy, those scenarios, if there is not a person in the designated assisted living portion of the building dedicated solely to the people living in that particular in those particular sections, they are not eligible to receive or provide 24-hour supervision. In the case of one provider that contacted us, that means that essentially the clients living in those assisted living units, when they develop needs that are such that require 24-hour supervision, they would most likely have to be transferred to a nursing home setting in order to be both financially viable for the provider as well as meeting the needs of the client. This, again, is an area where they're looking for a little bit of flexibility. Again, we are trying to narrowly craft it and are working with the department to craft it and tailor it even further to explicitly designate that they must be attached to a hospital or a nursing home. And, again, are for small providers. And certainly appreciate the concerns raised by the others involved in this issue, and will continue to work with this, but appreciate the opportunity to bring this issue forward.
Questions from the committee? Senator Erickson Rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last one. Senator Lynch, thank you for working on this bill. As we're looking at loosening up mandates and unhamstringing various assorted government units, some are being proposed as waivers through the economic stress that we're under, and others are being proposed as permanent changes. What are these?
Mr. Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, all of the provision in the bill are permanent. I guess as permanent as anything is permanent
around here. All right. Thank you.
Senator Lynch moves Senate File 986, as amended, be recommended pass and referred to the Finance. No other committees. I guess one wanted it, but you took out the sections that they were concerned about. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much.
Popular bill, everybody's leaving.
Exactly. Yeah.
Must have been the popular bill, everybody's leaving.
We heard a lot of proposals.
People can leave quietly. We want to continue the meeting. We've got three more bills, and we've already been here 2 hours, so we're half done.
What is next to liberal?
Welcome to the committee, Senator Burma.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment for Senate File 696. It's an A1 amendment.
I believe it's in the packets already. So, Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Chairman and members of the committee. I've been working this year trying to come up with some ways, alternative ways, to save money in the budget. And this is one of them. This is requiring that patient-centered decision-making process be used before certain treatments are advanced that could be invasive where alternative treatments exist. And this was recommended out of a couple of working groups of the Healthcare Access Commission last year. And so I'm just going to read a little bit of the testimony that was taken in regard to this concept. An analysis of 29 randomized controlled trials of 21 treatment decision aids indicated that when used, they consistently led to superior effects relative to usual practices when looking at decision quality. In addition, patients who used decision aids had lower decisional conflict, participated more actively in decision making, and were less likely to remain undecided. Furthermore, exposure to decision aids reduced elective invasive surgical procedures in favor of more conservative options by 24% without adverse effects on patients' health outcomes, satisfaction, or anxiety. So the reason that the bill cites certain conditions for using the decision-making, patient-centered decision-making process is because we know that there are decision-making aids readily available for these types of conditions. In fact, we have them not only in available to providers on CD disc formats, but they're also available on the internet. Furthermore, the internet provides nurses with training about how to use decision-making tools. There may be others that are appropriate for the list, but this time I haven't heard from anyone about additions that they would recommend. So the way that this would work is before a patient would be referred to a surgeon, for example, for one of these procedures, they would have a decision-making process involving the patient used, and the patient would indicate whether they wanted a more conservative approach to their treatment or not. And based on that, the referral would be made. And the bill applies both to our programs in terms of our healthcare services as well as those that are available for our state employees. And and we've chosen the date of January 1st, 2010 because that would be the first time that the health plan contracts could be amended to include this provision. Can answer any questions that anyone has, or we could call on Dr. Tigerson to give his testimony.
Dr. Tigerson, you want to start now? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dr. Marcus Tigerson, Associate Medical Director at Health Partners. Senator Berglund has already, I think, nicely articulated the fairly large amount of evidence in the medical literature documenting the value of patient-centered decision support, or shared decision-making as also known, for helping patients and doctors make better medical decisions. I wanted to just make a few comments about what what the standard sort of approach is to shared decision making, and then talk a little bit about some other additional points of value that it has, and then give you a quick update on what other things are going on in the state with respect to shared decision making at this time. Shared decision making is a little different from informed consent. I think that's one of the things that sometimes is confusing for people. Informed consent is a very standard process that all physicians follow when they're making a recommendation to a patient about a particular course of action that involves any meaningful risk to the patient, and particularly any kind of invasive procedure. The process of informed consent can sometimes resemble shared decision-making, but does not necessarily do so. In contrast, shared decision-making is particularly important when the patient is faced with multiple treatment options. You do informed consent whether there's just one treatment option or multiple ones, but where shared decision-making really is important is where the patient has multiple treatment options, all of which are typically relatively similar in terms of their health outcomes, but where the difference between the treatment options is really related to the trade-offs that the patient has in terms of the risks and benefits. And because there are different risks associated with different treatment options, there are trade-offs for the patient, and the best choice for them is going to be strongly dependent upon their preferences and values. And those are the situations where shared decision-making makes the most sense. It involves using techniques that are in addition to the kinds of things that doctors do for informed consent. And I will tell you, as a practicing physician, although I myself tried for many years to do a good job of offering my patients shared decision-making, it's only been in the last 5 years that I've gotten more educated about the actual techniques for doing it that I've realized that I having lacked formal training in the past, that I could have done a better job if I had been better trained. And so I've actually gotten some additional training myself, and that, as Senator Berglund indicated, is available on the Internet and is quite useful. In addition to the value of shared decision-making that Senator Berglund mentioned, I just wanted to mention a few other things that have been published in the medical literature recently. There's now some data that suggests that following a shared decision-making process reduces the risk for physicians of being sued for failure to inform. So there's some evidence that using a shared decision-making process reduces malpractice risk. There's also good evidence that using shared decision-making actually increases the utilization of preventive care services. It's been used to help people understand the value of getting preventive care services, and when done so, it seems to actually increase their use of those services. So those are two additional examples of the value. There's also reports about it actually improving the nature of the conversation and communication between doctors and patients and making the patient education process more efficient. My last comments are just about some of the things that are going on in the state with respect to shared decision making at this time. There are a number of medical groups around the state that have been piloting or in various ways trying to implement shared decision making for specific kinds of services. Stillwater Medical Group has been done a couple of pilots, first with gynecology services and now with prostate surgery. Health Partners is piloting shared decision-making for breast cancer, and the Mayo Clinic has a number of shared decision-making programs going as well. A bunch of us got together a few months ago and started what we call the Minnesota Shared Decision-Making Collaborative. It's a multi-stakeholder group of about 20 organizations, gathering the people in the state together who are working on this to share our learnings and to work together to try to move the shared decision-making agenda forward so that in the near future we can have this be a readily available service for patients in the clinic. A number of health plans provide shared decision-making over the phone, but we think it's most effectively provided if it's done in the clinic by their own personal physician.
Thank you. Questions for the doctor? Senator Higgins.
Doctor, does this decision-making process not only help the patient choose between one type of treatment and another, but also treatment and no treatment?
Right. No treatment is always a treatment option. Although oftentimes people want some kind of treatment, but that's certainly an option, and that's part of the shared decision-making process, is to help them understand that that is an option.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brooklyn.
Usually it's discussed with a patient in terms of watchful waiting, that, you know, waiting to see what happens with the progress of a disease is a viable option sometimes, and sometimes we'll have a better outcome than, you know, an invasive procedure that's non-reversible, for example.
Senator Erickson Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund, for the doctor, I guess I'm reverting back to some of my old definitions of patient-centered decision-making and things like that, as opposed to patient education. And this one seems to, in the third section here, 3.5 to 3.7, it ends up saying, or through the use of electronic decision aids. So that would seem to be plugging in a DVD and they have patients watch it. And is that qualify as patient-directed decision-making?
Senator Erickson Ropes and Mr. Chairman, there are probably three key components to shared decision-making. The first one actually is to have some kind of structured process to make sure that, to guide the process so that you can be assured that all the sort of key aspects of the decision are being addressed. At Health Partners, we actually use a form that it's readily available over the Internet that comes actually from the Ottawa Health Research Institute. It's called the Ottawa Decision Guide, and it basically helps you, walks you through a decision and helps you think about your options and the pros and cons of the different options and think about what kind of information you need to make a better decision and what kind of support you need and who might be influencing you. In fact, it's such a good decision guide that you can use it for lots of other non-medical decisions. Mm-hmm. So that'd be the first component. The second component is what we call decision aids, and decision aids are those kinds of educational materials that give people the information they need to make a well-informed decision, and those can be delivered online with a video or in the privacy of your home, or they can be just a simple pamphlet. And then the third component is coaching or discussion with an expert a clinician who's been trained in this technique to help identify any areas of ambivalence or residual lack of information or other issues that need to be addressed to help the patient make a good decision.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That was very helpful to hear. In that definitions section, though, the only pieces of that I see there are the structured process. We're talking about sort of a decision guide and maybe the decision aids. And I'm not opposed to patient education. I think this is really key to getting to helping them make a good decision. But I don't see any kind of opportunity in your definition for that one-to-one or that coaching discussion in that definition. It just seems to me to be directed interaction, which means somebody's telling somebody something, and then being exposed to the use of electronic decision aids. But it doesn't have anything in there at all about any kind of one-to-one or human sort of interaction.
Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, it says a process that involves directed interaction with the patient to assist the patient in arriving at an informed, objective healthcare decision. The interaction may be conducted by a healthcare provider, that would be a human being, okay, or through the electronic use of a decision. And in most cases, it would be both. Information provided, and then there would be a discussion with the provider.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, it says or. It doesn't say and. So
well, it
could
be or it could be and.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Bergel, I guess that's to my point about the definition doesn't have a requirement for a coaching discussion opportunity. It could be, but it doesn't have to. Or am I not understanding something?
Well, it might be that you would ask the person to look at an electronic decision-making aid. And there always is an office visit that accompanies this. Usually there would be, unless the person is watching it at home and decides not to go into the office for some reason. But so there would always be an office visit with this, and this would be done prior to a referral to a specialist. So I'm assuming that there's human interaction in that regard.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, again, I would hope so. And I heard you, you know, wanting to make sure that sort of thing is on the record earlier in conversations this evening. So I would be reassured if I would be told that it's possible that we're not just going to be putting patients in rooms and having them look through material and watch DVDs, and then that's the end of their patient-centered process experience. If you tell me there are going to be human beings involved where you actually do have an opportunity to get to this third point where people have an opportunity for discussion and coaching, then I would be reassured.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson-Ropes, it could be done by a healthcare provider. But I think in most cases, healthcare providers would find it useful to have additional tools to help them.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Berglund. I'm not sure if you or your witness could answer. I've got a couple of questions. One on page 2 of the bill where it says that the commissioners shall require active participation before reimbursement is paid. That doesn't tell me when that decision-making process has to take place. It seems
well,
like
that
would certainly...
in the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund.
So it would be prior to a referral to a surgeon or specialist for one of these conditions.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, this would have to be done then prior to a person actually having the surgery. That was one of the questions I had, is the way I read that. I thought they could do this after the surgery and still comply with it, but... second question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, the list of conditions, and you mentioned in your testimony that that's because there were these aids already available on the Internet or some that there was something already in place for that, but that it could be changed or added to by the commissioners and published on the State Register. And I guess I would have some concern about that. How are people to know, if they did that, when a change was made? So if there was an additional condition put on that required this process to be done before reimbursement and it was published on the State Register, how would patients know that, and how would providers know that that was being contemplated, and how would they have any input into the decision to put that particular procedure on this list? There doesn't seem to be any rulemaking or public hearing involved, just the decisions by the commissioner. And I'm concerned about that. I'm not sure that that is a good process if you're saying reimbursement will only occur when this happens on these procedures, and then the list of procedures can be made as long or as short as it would be by the action of two commissioners.
Mr. Chairman, usually when the commissioner would be adding something, it would go through a process within the Department of Human Services in regard to that decision-making process, and notices are provided to the public and others in regard to that. In regard to these particular procedures, as I indicated, there are a range of treatment options available that in various circumstances are equally effective. There are decision-making aids available for providers and consumers to use, so that's why these were selected.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I appreciate that. That's your earlier testimony mentioned that, but is there nothing?
Well, there would be the opportunity for more alternative treatments to be available as time goes on for various procedures, and more patient-centered decision-making aids become available. And so I didn't want to just have the bill imply that this is the only things you would ever use them for.
And Mr. Chairman, that's part of my concern, is that I'm not sure what the information that is to be provided. And it could be, I guess, a variety of different things. If it's going to be construed broadly to be anything, then anything would qualify as a decision-making aid. If it's to be construed narrowly, then I think there are questions about who provides the information and where does it come from, and who are considered the authorities to provide that information, and all that is not talked about at all. So I'm a little concerned about the broadness of this, making it a condition of reimbursement, and then having this list be put together in a way that I think is a little troubling, at least to me.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I didn't quite understand sort of the basis of your concern, but I understand better now, I think. The decision-making tools that are generally used have been approved by organizations at the federal level in order to make sure that the information provided is A, accurate, and B, objective in regard to the efficacy of the treatment, the potential side effects of the treatment, et cetera. And we would expect that we would be using decision-making aids that have been have met those kind of standards.
Mr. Chairman, would that be something that should be amended then, is to make a specific, I guess, I'm unfamiliar with these aids and what the criteria are for, and what are the federal organizations that have promulgated them, but I'm a little uncomfortable saying we're going to make people comply with a process that is not, at least as I understand it, very well defined. And I'm just concerned about that, and what does that mean, and what kinds of things are we going to require people to do, and if it's some agency has got some kind of process that they've defined, then maybe we ought to put that in the bill and say you have to go through this to comply with the requirement of the law. But if it isn't that, if it's more broad, then I guess I'm thinking, well, we could make this list very long, and we could have all kinds of decision-making aids that could be made and put out by anybody, and it would all fit. I'm not sure what this is. I'm so confused about what we're doing here with this.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, I'd be happy to work with you on clarifying language between now and the Finance Committee to take care of that concern. I'm not opposed to the idea of setting some standard for the tools that are used, but I'm not ready to do that right now, tonight, in terms of having appropriate language.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think Senator Hahn's point would be well taken. It's a really odd collection of conditions that are listed there. I think the one that jumps out at me is the TMJ dysfunction. I'll just leave it as it's odd. But the thing that that jumps out at me in this new language in this bill is that the word physician doesn't appear anywhere in here. There's a referral referenced in the amendments, but it's just missing. So,
Senator Burton,
could this be done by a clinical staff person, not a physician? Can this be done by a videotape? Could this be something that you send to them on the computer and you download it and watch it? I'm kind of unfamiliar with the whole thing, too. I mean, I've seen glaucoma tapes and those kinds of things in my physician's office, and
And I guess I'm just looking for a little more information. I'm like Senator Hahn. I don't really know this very well.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I think I can answer that question. The decision aids, which, as I said, can be print material, can be, video over the Internet kind of thing, are materials that typically the patient will, use on their own, whether it's at home in some cases or some physicians actually, create a little workstation where they have their patients sit down and watch something on a computer to get educated. The decision coaching part of the process can also be delivered in a variable way. In some practices, there are nurses who have been trained to do this who talk with the patient about the process and review the information in the decision aid with the patient, answer some of their questions, and identify things like, are you feeling pressure from somebody in terms of making the decision? What additional information you feel you need to know? And so they'll work with the patient to kind of try to help them resolve ambivalence or to help them explore the decision. And then once the patient's sort of gone through that process, then ultimately the patient does typically reconnect with the physician if the physician hasn't been the person doing that all along. I mean, as I told you in my testimony, as a physician, I always have tried to follow the shared decision-making approach with my patients, helping them to make decisions. And so many physicians, I think, very much try to practice this way. But there are also physicians who I think will want to delegate this particular decision coaching process to a trusted clinician in their practice, like a nurse. But ultimately, once that patient has gone through that process, the final part is for them to sit down and talk with their doctor about the decision and the options and what they're thinking about the decision, and it becomes a collaborative decision-making process with the physician.
And Madam Chair, just one
Senator
last
Hayden.
Question. Senator Berglund, is this expected to save money somehow?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes.
How? Sorry,
because
Madam Chair.
Most of the time, people will choose a more conservative type of treatment if they're given all of the information and all of the options. As I said in my opening statement, we had testimony that was presented to the Healthcare Access Commission, an analysis of 29 randomized control trials, of which 21 decision aids were used. More conservative options were chosen 24% of the time without adverse effects on the patient's health outcome, satisfaction, or anxiety.
Madam Chair, if 24% chose the more conservative, that means that 76% chose the less conservative.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, 24% more than would have chosen the less conservative in a setting where no decision-making tools were used or no patient-centered decision-making was attempted.
Senator Lori. Senator Higgins, are you
done? Yeah, my brain's twisted around that one, so go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, and actually I'm going to follow up on Senator Hans and Senator Higgins' point, and I've seen some of those studies too, that and really do believe that there is cost savings to be driven out of the system by giving good advice and bringing the patient in as part of it. But I think that we're trying to get around here, and we would be well served to take Senator Berglund on getting some more specificity in here on exactly what it means, because I do worry that without that specificity and that tie to the randomized controlled trials that demonstrate a savings, we'll have a hard time getting them booked as this bill moves forward. So maybe we should, for the policy for this committee, I believe that the policy really is there. There are good studies that demonstrate you can get to a cost savings. We've already acknowledged that we need to work more on some of the specificity to get there. And I believe that would actually help us get that fiscal note out of there. So I'm going to be a strong supporter of moving this forward out of this committee. We don't have the language to make it more specific today, but I think it is something well worth looking at the policy and trying to get that level of detail that will yield us the cost savings that we all want to see.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. Senator Berglund, there are two people who are listed to testify. Are we ready to proceed with that? Thank you. We have Ms. Sarah Nosnicki, I believe.
Close, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Sarah Nosnicki. I'm representing the Minnesota Medical Association. I want to be very clear at the outset that the MMA is supportive of patient-centered decision-making, and we support expanded adoption of tools to ensure that patients receive the most appropriate care. So we don't disagree with much that's been stated here. It's very valuable. It's been discussed at length by our quality committee and other groups as well. But we support shared decision-making between patients and their physicians, although we believe that there might be a better mechanism to implement this rather than in statute. I think the conversation among committee members has touched on a lot of things, issues and things that we've raised. Instead of the bill, we actually suggest a thoughtful community-wide discussion about how to accomplish shared decision-making, evaluating the research that's been discussed, considering the details related to implementation and how this would actually work in practice. One mechanism to do this may be, and there might be others, the Health Services Advisory Council at Department of Human Services. They make many similar analyses related to coverage and benefits for these patient populations. They sort of have the infrastructure already set up, I believe, to go ahead and take a look at this. And it sounds like they may have already been on the track to do to develop or work with a tool similar to this for one condition already. But for the committee right now, I'd just like to highlight a few specific examples of items that seem to require this kind of additional consideration. A number of them, like I said, have already been touched on. The first one, line 2.27 refers to, quote-unquote, active participation. What's the definition of active? Does watching a video meet that standard? Will you be compensated for the surgery if that's what the patient has done? Very good question, Senator Erickson-Ropes. Line 3.6, requiring that interaction be conducted by a, quote, a healthcare provider. Is this the patient's primary care physician? Is this the surgeon that's going to be doing the surgery? Can the task be delegated to a nurse? We've talked about a lot of those things already, but the bill isn't clear. Also, will health plans try to use their nurses on staff to do this and taking it out of the physician-patient relationship? The third thing was which decision aids and tools will qualify. Could each PMAT plan potentially require a different decision-making aid to qualify for the reimbursement? Are we going to create an administrative nightmare here for providers? Next, will the time and cost associated with this be reimbursed? If they have to buy videos, if they have to have one-on-one coaching, there would be expense to that, even if it was by a nurse. If we're talking about 20 or 30 minutes, even 5 minutes to take a staff person in that clinic out of those other roles and responsibilities. Next, how is the process documented to obtain payment for surgery? Is it a checkoff on the patient's medical record? Do they sign something like informed consent? Or is it really any different than prior authorization? How about cultural and language differences? Are these tools available in multiple languages? Who pays to develop them and acquire all of the different languages that they would need? What happens if a patient refuses to participate? Can they proceed with the surgery they want if they won't go through the process? Or does the physician have to say to them, I'm sorry, if you won't do this, I can't treat you? In general, patient-centered decision-making is a really important tool. We encourage you to thoughtfully and carefully implement the process with community buy-in so we can get it right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair, I just have one comment, and that is one thing I do know. A community-wide conversation does not produce a fiscal note. We have community-wide conversations about this in the Healthcare Access Commission working group, several of them. And we even put it in as one of the conditions of being a medical home. And thus far, we've gotten zero fiscal note savings on any of that. So, well, I think there might be easier ways to balance a budget, you know, like just eliminate some services. I think this would be a better way. And so I think in spite of what the questions are that have been raised, we should move ahead. And as I said earlier, you know, decision-making tools are available on the Internet free of charge, and the training for how to use them is available on the Internet free of charge. The major problem here is getting them to be used, and this bill will make sure they're used in these particular treatment modalities.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, just I appreciate and believe that you're right, that having these kinds of decision processes undertaken probably result in better decisions and savings, although I think some of the concerns that were just raised about the how this works are legitimate. How do you know that it's happened? What are the things that qualify to, you know, to document or to say that you've actually done this? Those kinds of practical questions, and if there are costs associated with them, how they're going to be covered. Are you saying that those questions will be answered by the time the bill gets through the committee process, even though we may not have that here today? I'd be uncomfortable adopting this as a done deal without those kinds of questions addressed.
Well, there would have to be documentation that the decision-making process had been followed and that the decision made by the patient was based on that information having been provided to them. So it would have to be documentation in the patient's record that was the case. But, anything that's available free of charge on the Internet usually can be translated into other languages. The discussion about what treatment a person should have is part of what the payment is for today. So I don't believe we should be having to pay additional amounts of money to ask for people to be given information prior to that decision actually being made in the doctor's office with the doctor.
Thank you, members. We have another witness, Wanda Tepley. Is she here? Is she... Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chairman. I represent the Minnesota Association of Ambulatory Care Centers, and we're not formally opposing this bill, but we wanted to be present to be able to address some of the same concerns that obviously have been tackled before, and I won't beleaguer some of those issues because we certainly had concerns about clarification on some of the definitions that you alluded to. We also have concerns about what assessment tools would be used. Also, how would you address any language barrier issues? Interpreters do not come cheap for a lot of these individual clinics, so there is additional cost associated with that. We also had concerns about documentation strategies and getting that documentation to our particular centers so that surgery could be done. Implementation, how are we to implement it? How are we to monitor it? Some of the other things that I think were not addressed were, what about emergency situations? Some of these conditions require emergency surgery. And so is there a clause that outs for the patient to be able to have those procedures in an emergency condition without going through these aids? And currently, the way I see this bill, there is none. What about compliance and noncompliance issues of the various clinics? Is there any retribution or any fallback for when these clinics don't comply with it and I can't get paid for the various procedure? So it's not that we're really opposed to patient education. I think it's wonderful. Patient-centered decisions have been a hallmark of associations such as the Ambulatory Care Center, and we've always looked for ways to improve situations, such as working with the Minnesota Alliance for Patient Safety, who works our informed consent. At this point, the association, although not giving a formal opposition or a voice of approval for this, would like to be able to work on this and provide some clarification as to how it is workable without being burdensome.
Thank you, Ms. Tepley. Any questions? If we don't have any more questions, Senator Berglund, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd move that Senate File 696 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill is adopted. Senator Berglund, you have Senate File 633.
Madam Chair, I have an A2 amendment.
Do members have the amendment before them?
We have an A1. Here. It's being passed out.
A1 amendment.
It's being passed out right now. Members, all of those in favor of the A2 amendment signifying by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Berger.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill is trying to get more dental prevention during the well-child visits that children are seen for in our state. And one of the things that is allowed during a well-child visit is the application of fluoride varnish. And I believe that if we are getting that to happen more often in connection with a well-child visit, that we would see less childhood caries and less need for remediation. So that's generally the thrust of the bill. I'd like to have Dr. Diner come up to the table to talk about the bill and the efforts he's been making in regard to this.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you tonight about a topic which has become a passion of mine for the last 8 years. My name is Amos Dinard. I'm a primary care pediatrician, a master's in public health, and I've spent the last 40 years working in the public sector, first as pediatric consultant to the Minneapolis Health Department's Maternal Child Health Program for 15 years, followed by 15 years running Community University Healthcare Center, otherwise known as COOC, on Franklin and Bloomington in South Minneapolis. And it was there that I suddenly became aware of the difficulties that public program patients began to have in the mid-90s getting dental care. When I was in training back in the dark ages, we didn't really think about the teeth other than to count them in cases of slow growth because delayed dentition and short stature often track together. But there were dentists in the community who would see everybody. Starting in about 1995, nationwide, that changed. So at COOC, when we were full up on the dental clinic of an afternoon and it was a child who needed care, the dental director began to have more and more difficulty finding a dentist who would see the child. In 2000, I had the good fortune of going to the first ever Surgeon General's Conference on Oral Health in America. And there I met Olson Huff, a retired pediatrician from North Carolina, who told me what he was doing in North Carolina to train primary care medical providers, pediatricians and family medicine practitioners, as well as the nurse practitioners in pediatrics and family medicine and physician assistants, how to do primary caries prevention as part of well child care. And he challenged me to come back to Minneapolis and replicate what he was doing in North Carolina. Well, fortunately, in 1999, the Department of Human Services created a dental access task force. So the DHS was sensitized to the problem already. So when I came back from the Surgeon General's Conference, I called DHS and asked, I've been challenged, will you reimburse physicians for doing primary caries prevention? And it didn't require a committee. In about 1 second, the answer was, yes, we'll pay. And then DHS wrote the health plans and said, here's what we're doing. We trust you'll do the same thing. And immediately all 9 health plans in the state agreed also that they would reimburse physicians for doing primary caries prevention. That has been in place since 2003. I set about creating a web-based training program to train physicians. Physicians can get a continuing ed credit for completing the training. I've got an atlas of common dental pathology that shows physicians pictures of things that they might not recognize. And the reality is that caries is an infectious disease and as such is theoretically preventable. It's the most common chronic disease of childhood. five times more common than asthma and seven times more common than hay fever. 80% of disease is found in 20% of kids. And when I use caries, I'm using the term, that term describes the process. The end result of the process is the hole, the cavity. 80% of disease is in 20% of kids, and those are the Medicaid, the Minnesota Care, and the working poor uninsured, by and large. 50% or more of children go with untreated dental disease. 2 years ago, a child died of a brain abscess in Maryland, in part, at least, because he had an abscess tooth and no dentist who could care for him. There are other circumstances involved in that case, but nonetheless, there was a death following an abscess tooth. Same time, a child died in Mississippi of sepsis, generalized infection, for the same reason. Dental caries prevention is easy. It is as primary prevention is to try to prevent a problem from ever occurring. Immunizations is probably the best example in primary care that I think our trainees in pediatrics today hardly ever see a case of measles. I saw lots when I was in training back in the 60s. So primary caries prevention involves five key elements, three of which at least are part and parcel, I believe, of primary care. Doing a full examination of the child, which includes looking at the teeth, not with a probe and x-rays as a dentist would, but just looking. I like to use the word eyeballing, but I'm told that that doesn't fit well into legislation. But nonetheless, taking a gross look at the teeth. Second, risk assessment, a 15-second paper and pencil measure that can be completed by the person who weighs the child in, determines rather quickly whether a child is high risk or low risk. Thirdly, anticipatory guidance. We advise caregivers about numerous topics. Another one added to the plate should be primary caries prevention, because the mother has probably even a greater role to play in caries prevention than does fluoride. Fluoride, generally, of the water, was voted in about 5 years ago as one of the 10 most important public health measures of the last half century. It has cut the caries rate considerably, but those children who have fewer caries because of fluoridated water also have access to regular dental care, by and large. So anticipatory guidance, advising the mother, don't put the pacifier in your mouth before you put it in the child's mouth, because you're now seeding the bacteria that cause caries into your child's mouth. It's a pretty simple process. The bugs in the plaque and the sugars in the food, and the bugs digest the sugars for their own metabolic purposes, create acid excrement, which etches the enamel of the tooth, and the caries process is started. So mothers need to understand about why they shouldn't put the child to bed with a bottle at night with sugar in it. If you have to put a child to bed with a bottle, have water, nothing else, not even sugared water. They need to understand it. You don't just dictate, don't do this, and without an explanation. That's what anticipatory guidance is about. And then every child should have a dental home by age one. That's the policy of the American Academies of Pediatrics and Pediatric Dentistry. Having a home and finding a home are two different matters. But lastly is the application of the fluoride varnish. It has a protective effect. It's been shown, a recent study from California showed, if you put varnish on once a year, you reduce the caries rate by 50%. If you put it on a second time during the year, you reduce the caries rate another 50%. Currently, the American Dental Association's policy is that every high-risk child should get fluoride varnish on a quarterly basis. The state will reimburse for that on a quarterly basis. The reimbursement is not an issue here. This is a budget-neutral consideration. So I agree. I think discussion is good, and I could well imagine it being suggested that if the academies of pediatrics and family medicine got together, it could all be worked out. One could say thou should wear a seatbelt, but would we have fewer or more head trauma in little children when it says should rather than shall? What would the mortality rate for measles and whooping cough and diphtheria be if the ground rules were, oh, you should give immunizations rather than you shall give immunizations? I think I'll stop here in the interest of time and field whatever questions you might have. This, as I said, this is a budget neutral, and it's really adding one tiny little element to the well-child exam, namely, that's over and above what we have been taught to do, and that is putting the varnish on. And that is a task that can be delegated to a certified medical assistant, an LPN, a volunteer, understanding orders from the physician. The physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant learns how to do it, and then delegates the responsibility, as they delegate a lot of other responsibilities in the clinic. It takes about 5 minutes or less to put the varnish on. It dries on contact. Dealing with the language issue, The instructions, post-virus instructions, have been translated into Somali, Oromo, Hmong, Lao, Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Spanish. All are available on the Internet. I've put them out there. And I'm also demonstrating right now in a WIC clinic in South Minneapolis where I have a Somali and a Hispanic translator trained to put varnish on, that in the last 15 months we've done 1,400 kids, a number for two times, a smaller number for three, and a handful already four times in that year. Mothers are coming in to get the varnishing without even needing their coupons that day. They know the varnish is there, and they're coming in seeking it out. We've had absolutely no patients dissatisfied. Every patient is accepted at Stafford. Are perfectly comfortable with the process added to at the WIC clinic. So I will stop and field whatever questions any one of you may have.
Questions for Dr. Diner? Not, you may have answered all their questions. We have a couple of witnesses in opposition.
Thank you very much.
Dr. John Andrews and Pat LaFontaine. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead, Dr. Andrews.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is John Andrews. I'm a pediatrician at the University of Minnesota and at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minnesota, and I represent the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We're very supportive of caries prevention, and we share both Senator Berglund and Dr. Deinert's frustration about the availability of dentists to treat our medical assistance patients. But we're not here to talk about dentists. This is a bill that mandates responsibility for provision of certain dental services by primary care physicians. Both locally and at the national level, our organizations recognize the need for increased access to caries prevention, and we're developing tools to help primary care physicians obtain training and resources to fill that growing gap. We appreciate a number of the amendments the author has made to the bill to address updated standards of care and reimbursement issues. We would truly like to support this bill, but have concerns with a few remaining items that we hope can be resolved. The primary question for the committee to consider seems to be who should provide primary caries prevention and what is the best way to promote broad-based adoption of this practice. We would support this bill in the event the language reads that the provider may include primary caries prevention rather than must. As you know, primary care providers are being asked to do more and more, and while this is a very important aspect of overall health that a growing number of primary care providers are comfortable providing, it does require training beyond their traditional expertise, and not every practice in the state has the capacity to add it at this time. You've heard that it only takes 15 seconds to do the cursory oral exam, 30 seconds to do the risk assessment, and 2 minutes to apply the varnish. Well, unfortunately, there are many things we're required to do in this brief visit with a patient and their family, and each of these two-minute items adds up. The 15 minutes often allotted for health supervision visits rapidly disappears. And we often brag about Minnesota as being ahead of the curve for child health, whether it's our newborn screening program, vaccination rates, or low rates of uninsured. It's certainly something to be proud of. We're ahead of the curve on primary caries prevention as well. DHS already allows medical assistants to reimburse primary care providers to apply fluoride varnish. Reimbursement for primary care providers to apply the varnish went into effect in late 2006. But at roughly 2 years old, this is a relatively new initiative here in Minnesota, and the same is true nationwide. We believe that with time and additional community buy-in, there could be broad adoption of primary caries prevention without a mandate from the legislature. Many clinics that have recently adopted this practice report very positive experiences, but mandating it for immediate adoption is another thing entirely. Rather than mandate these services, we believe there are opportunities to promote and accelerate adoption of this practice among our members statewide. You may not be aware that Minnesota has recently established the Minnesota Child Health Improvement Partnership. This advisory committee includes parents, providers, the Department of Health and Human Services, health plans, and others, and this seems like an appropriate project for the Improvement Partnership to consider. In closing, I want to reiterate that we believe dental care is a critical part of optimal child health, and we look forward to working with Senator Bergling and Dr. Deinert. We're hopeful we can resolve these remaining issues and send a clear message about the importance of prevention overall. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Dr. Andrews. A quick question. How many pediatricians do you think are doing this now?
I don't know the answer to that question. It would be a minority.
But presumably they do it already. So pediatricians are split over whether they want to do this or not. And you're saying there may be more buy-in in time or something?
Well, elements of this are in place in most pediatric practices. Inspection of the oral cavity, risk assessment for caries is a general part of health supervision. It's the application of the fluoride varnish that's quite burdensome to many practices. It's a task that often gets delegated to LPNs or certified medical assistants, and they would require additional training to do it. And clinics may require additional staffing in order to implement something like this, even though it seems like it takes a relatively short amount of time.
Other questions from the committee? If not, thank you, Dr. LaFontaine. Dr. Fontaine, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Pat Fontaine. I'm speaking to you as the president-elect of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, an organization with 3,000 members spread over the state in both large and small primary care practices. In addition, I am a member of the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Minnesota. I have worked with my esteemed colleague, Dr. Dinard, and it is with some reluctance that I'm testifying in opposition to the bill. However, the reluctance stems from the fact that as family physicians, we are dedicated to patient-centered care and to the concept of prevention. We certainly see in our patients the pain and complications caused by poor dental care over time. For example, children whose cavities have progressed to the point they must be treated with extractions in the operated room. And we in family medicine have the unique perspective of seeing adults who bounce from clinic to emergency room and back to clinic, seeking strong pain medication for chronically untreated dental caries and abscesses. I want to tell you that we are willing to do our part to help out with this problem. But I want to echo my colleagues' statements, because so many of the points that he made were so well put. Particularly the primary question for this committee to consider seems to be who should provide the caries prevention and what is the best way to promote broad-based adoption of the practice. Because as legislators, you are tinkering with a part of the entire healthcare system that involves not only physicians, but also dentists. To date, the scope of practice for family physicians has not included risk assessment for primary caries prevention, nor the application of fluoride varnish. I can tell you definitively that there is no routine education for this in family medicine residencies. The MAFP, and through Dr. Dinert's efforts, for which we certainly commend, there has been some education among our members, but we certainly need more. Already, a very small number of family medicine practices have voluntarily added dental screening and fluoride varnish to their services. I know of two, one of which was a recent pilot on the east side here. These physicians do it because they feel it's in the best interest of their patients. However, I am, in my official capacity, bound to tell you that a great number of members express concerns, and I brought a few quotes for you. I personally do not feel comfortable doing this, as I have never been trained in how to do it, and if it became mandatory, I would have to either get training or quit doing well-child exams, which would certainly be an issue in many of our rural communities that lack pediatricians. Another quote, this bill seems to demand an expertise that not all of us would feel comfortable with. It would also appear to require that for essentially no additional reimbursement, we perform a service that dentists who are trained to perform the service have refused to, and we can only speculate on the motivation there. Giving it a positive twist, one of our members said, well, we're doing it, and, you know, it's our philosophy that, you know, for every cavity saved, it's priceless. And the reply to that was, yes, it may not be as much of a time and training burden as we might fear, but it still is a time burden. And I have seen over the last few years more and more being put on our medical assistants as well as us as physicians. And I sense a growing frustration among our own staff. We've heard testimony about how simple it is to do this. We've heard testimony in another bill about how simple it would be to provide evidence-based decision-making that would require only interpreters, maybe a revision of your office with a little station where you could have a laptop or a DVD player. All of these little practice redesigns add up to really a lot, and they're all placed on the back of the primary care physician. And I just want to say to you all, we are willing to be with you. We are challenged to implement healthcare reform, and we are willing to be with you. But you put one more thing on our back, and at some point, you know, what if Atlas shrugs? Atlas is already shrugging. We have people going away from primary care specialties in droves. Surgeons are highly compensated. Dentists are highly compensated. There's a certain amount of parity that needs to be built into the healthcare system. So I guess there's a strong sentiment among family physicians that any attempt to bring this legislation forward should be accompanied by legislative measures to ensure that dentists and dental insurance plans take reasonable steps to ensure that medical assistance patients can get necessary dental care in dental offices, and that a plan to have medical and dental societies work together to create logistical plan for identifying, educating, and reimbursing the personnel to perform this. To that effect, our current president, Dr. Dave Hutchison, has already sent a letter to the president of the American Dental Association hoping to open lines of communication. So, once again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. We definitely want to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. And I feel that the MAFP would support this bill if it were not a mandate that we feel, unfortunately, given some of the quotes I brought here tonight, could create a backlash that would be very difficult for us to deal with.
Thank you, Dr. Fontaine. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Fontaine, don't physicians have a certain number of hours of continuing medical education they have to have every year?
That is correct.
And
every 3 years, there's a certain number that must be met to continue medical licensure in the state of Minnesota.
Would it not be possible to have a little in-service that would kill two birds with one stone, to learn this process and get a little credit for it as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, that is exactly what we would like to do. We would like to be able to do that under conditions where our members are eager to undergo the training rather than feeling put upon and unimbursed for the training and the other modifications they must make for their staff and in their office practices.
And Mr. Chair, a couple more questions, if I could. One for Senator Berglund. Senator Berglund, is testing blood lead levels part of the well baby check?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, yes, it is.
And then Dr. Fontaine, do most of your doctors do that test that's mandated?
Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, they do. That hasn't been an issue.
Were you practicing when that became part of the sorry, Mr. Chair, it's late. Were you practicing when that became a mandate? And was there the same sort of hue and cry against that?
Senator Higgins and Chair, I would have to say that the situation was quite different because offices at that point were already set up with ways to have blood drawn. This was another blood draw that was added to tests that were already being done, so there was really no additional change in office redesign, no additional training, no additional re-engineering staff roles to accommodate getting a lead level.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and members, I just remind you that this bill does not require the physician to apply fluoride varnish. It can be done by another trained person. It doesn't even have to be a nurse that does it. So it doesn't seem to me like the burden is as great as is being described here by the witness. And I think it's a more of a matter of will than it is of cost. And it just seems to me that most children in our state, in our public programs, are getting well child visits. This would be something that could be done at the same time and would drastically reduce the amount of dental work that would need to be done on children.
Dr. Diner?
I didn't want to brag earlier, but I will say, given the discussion we've had about the need for more training, I currently have funding from UCare Minnesota, Delta Dental, Medica Foundation, and the National Children's Oral Health Foundation. For the next 18 months or so, I can train any clinic in the state that wants to get trained. I can even come in and show you how to redesign your office to put two chairs together with a gooseneck lamp to do the varnishing, because that's all it takes. But the funds are there to do the training. And my colleague, Dr. Johnson, is sitting next to me. She and I are doing this together. We are working not only in the 7-county area. Brenda, raise your hand, please, so people can see who you are. We're working not only in the 7-county metropolitan area, but also statewide.
Senator Higgins.
You know, Mr. Chair, in one of my low moments here at the legislature, I asked Senator Berglund how she has been able to do this job for decades. And she's a very wise woman, and she said, if you don't keep learning things, you stagnate, and then you can't move forward. This is a place where we can remember that piece of advice.
Senator Hand.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Berglund, and I'm not sure who to address this question to, which of the doctors, or maybe no one, but it seems to me that when you write a law that says people have to do something, what you're really getting at is trying to compel someone to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do, that they're not going to do this unless we force them to do it. And yet we're hearing testimony from both sides here that this is a good thing and that people do it and will do it. And maybe it's a question of in what way or at what pace, and then we're going to write a law that says you have to do this. And I just find that ironic that we have people who are highly trained, medical professionals, know a lot more about healthcare than I do, and we're going to be asked to tell them how they should do what they need to do, and that their judgment about how to proceed with a good thing should be superseded by ours. And I'm a little troubled by that. And I don't see anybody here at the witness table objecting to this as a good thing, that everybody wants children's dental caries to be addressed and to be addressed appropriately, and nobody objects to that. The only objection I've heard is when people say, why are you making us do this when you may not fully understand all the constraints that we have to face? And we don't. And if we have highly trained people, well-educated people that have the best interests of children and health care at heart, why can't we let them, permit them to do this in a way that seems best to them? Why do we need to compel them to do something that they clearly wouldn't do without the compulsion unless we assume they're not competent to make that decision on their own? And I just raise that question because I'm troubled by this, as I am about some other things, the way we do healthcare. But in this in particular, I'm not sure why we have to compel people to do this.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, if we wanted to say you may do this, we don't need this bill because
exactly.
It may be done now.
Exactly.
We've heard that there's payment for it.
Exactly.
We've heard that there's training for it. But we've also heard that it isn't happening very many places. And so I think the issue is, if we want children to get this preventative service, then we need a bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, all those things you said, I agree with you. They're there. They're not happening. I think the bigger question would be is to ask why not. There may be some reasons, good reasons, why they're not happening, and just saying you have to do it may not address those reasons. And that's my point. I think the people that are doing it may know why it isn't happening, and they may be trying to address it in a way that makes sense. And for us to step in and say, well, forget all that, just do it, I'm concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I think we've heard, even in the testimony tonight, that some primary care physicians and pediatricians think somebody else should be doing this. My concern is not who should be doing this, but that it get done. And I think this is a way to make sure this gets done and that children benefit from this, that we haven't necessarily, it's an approach we haven't necessarily really pushed in the past. And it seems to me that it is a natural solution. You've got children in the doctor's office anyway, and they need to get certain other things done to maintain their health and prevent other things from happening to them. This would be a very simple thing that can happen in a short amount of time, for which there is training and reimbursement. And so it seems to me that if we care about the children and we care about their oral health, this is the way we should be going.
If I could add, in this day of cost containment, for every child age 1 to 2 to age 6 or 7 who had multiple carious teeth, which is very, very common, 50% of 5-year-olds have multiple caries in the high-risk populations. The only way that can be done is in ambulatory surgery under general anesthesia. First, there's a risk of an anesthetic death. And secondly, the charge, not what they get paid, but the charge is between $10,000 and $12,000 per child. Even if they get 50 cents on the dollar, for $6,000 you can buy a lot of fluoride varnish and put it on and do some primary prevention. Why do we dictate lead screening and immunizations? Why not just say, oh, well, give DPT if you want, but you don't have to. It's primary prevention. That's what I think is the most important, to keep a problem from ever arising.
Dr. Fontaine.
I would agree. And as I said, my specialty embodies prevention. It's one of our core tenets. And I think, in response to the question of why would we have this bill at all, I think this bill has done a great service. It has really brought the issue to the fore for our membership. It has promoted the pilot program that I mentioned, and I do know of two places where people are doing it, applying the fluoride varnishes. I am an educator myself. I have been with the University of Minnesota training medical students and practice and young family physicians for over 15 years, and education is my passion. We are certainly willing to educate, and we are always willing to learn new things, and our patients' well-being is our primary value. What we don't understand is, if you can mandate something for doctors, why can't you mandate the same thing for dentists? And I didn't really want to go there, but there is a fundamental issue of fairness and parity and who's already got the training and who's already got the office set up to do this. So I maybe should stop there.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, thank you for bringing these to our attention. I am very supportive of it. And I had a comment similar to Senator Higgins' comment. I really admire your tenacity and your courage to come back again and again. I was part of the hearings with the commission over the summer, and I can't tell you how many times I counted the statement, we really care about children, we know this needs to be done, but we are not the ones that should be doing it. Time and time again, in the healthcare system and in the schools, we really want to do this for kids. But you know what? We're not the ones. So I keep asking myself, then who are the ones? How are we going to really work on prevention if no one wants to do it? And, you know, Dr. Fontaine and Dr. Andrews, I understand your argument. But what I would appreciate as a senator here is not, I will not do it because we're overstressed and overworked. Perhaps the question or the argument that I will support is, we really want to do this. This is what it takes. We want you to move in this direction, and we will bring to you a request for getting it done the right way. But these arguments of somebody else needs to do it really are, in my view, very concerning. We do this again and again for children, and we're just never going to be able to make progress if every system in the healthcare system is just refusing to move in that direction. So thank you, Senator Berglund, for doing this.
Further discussion from members of the committee. Is there anybody else in the audience who needs to speak to the issue? If not, Senator Berglund moves Senate File 633 as amended be recommended to pass. Does this go to any other committee?
Well, I am not sure if this will have a fiscal note or not, so
really shouldn't, because
we don't think it should, but we never are sure.
The DHS and the health plans have already budgeted for it. They've been paying not since 2006, but since 2004. I get all the complaints about people who don't get reimbursed, and I haven't had a complaint in a couple of years.
So why don't we just say that this would go to the floor, and if we get a fiscal note, we'll send it to finance.
Senator Berglund moves Senate File 633 is amended be recommended pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Berglund, your last bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have an A3 amendment to this bill, and I'm going to move forward to the A3 amendment.
A3. A4. Senator Berglund, the A4 or the A3 or both?
Well, I need to move the A3 first, and then I'd like to move the A4 amendment to the A3.
Senator Berglund moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the A4 amendment, Senator Berglund moves the A4 amendment to the A3 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is another bill that I'm introducing to try to generate some savings. And the idea behind this bill is that Medicare does not pay for many errors that are made by hospitals. We do not pay for some of them, but there are others that we still do pay for. And so my thought is, you know, rather than cutting all hospital payments for some hospitals that don't have errors, that we should be looking at cutting errors first in the hopes that we will provide some incentive to prevent those errors from happening in the first place. And so the bill deals with our public health care programs and defines a condition to be hospital acquired if it's not identified by the hospital as present in admission. For certain adverse health events that Medicare does not pay for, we add that list to what Medicaid would not pay for either.
Maybe it's a mosquito.
We go on to say that in the case of an error where the error is committed by a physician, that reimbursement would not be paid as well. I'm not an expert on all these ICD codes, but I'm told by folks that have worked on language for me that it all works and is pretty much in compliance then with what. And hospitals are already on the lookout for these things because they know Medicare is not going to pay them. And so it's just sort of a natural thing for us to piggyback on it.
And I wonder if it's defined in
it. We have a letter from the Consumer Worker Coalition in support of this legislation.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I'm not sure if we can see someone here from the nurses to testify. If you would like to hear from them, it's getting late. If you don't.
Sure. Briefly.
Very briefly, Senator. Did you pass out our letter, too? Did the committee get the letter from the Minnesota Nurses Association?
I don't see it in the back.
Okay. Well, we'll get you a copy of our letter. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George with the Minnesota Nurses Association. We are here to support Senate File 460.
I have the letter if you want to make copies.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Chris. We'll get it, Senator Berger.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my staff says you have it. You're saying you don't, so.
Mr. Chair, we do support this bill because, as Senator Berglund said, we think it's a better approach to across-the-board cuts that we're anticipating are going to happen due to the state budget deficit. And so we think by targeting the cuts to not pay for errors and infections that our hospital acquired, that we can do a better job of two things. One, improving quality for patients, and two, hopefully addressing and improving the important role that nursing plays in preventing these errors and infections. And what I've outlined is, in the letter, is that many of these errors and infections are directly linked to nurse staffing. So, for example, pressure ulcers, falls with injuries, bloodstream infections, urinary tract infections are all really directly linked to the size and composition of the workforce. And so we think if we can incent hospitals to improve the quality, we're hopeful that they also will address and improve the nurse staffing that goes along with that. You know, of course, we're very concerned in these difficult times that hospitals are laying off essential nurse staffing, but we think that by focusing the cuts to look at quality, we can have a twofold strategy of improving the quality and eventually reducing costs that hospitals will see when they reduce these errors. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. George. Questions from the committee? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Berglund, and Ms. George, for your testimony. I just want to underscore, as a former nurse, I have my nursing license kept up, but as a former nurse who practices, you know, I also see a really strong link between some of these conditions that are listed here for non-payment, and I think we're following in the steps of the feds, just trying to get Minnesota in compliance. So one question I have, Senator Brogan, and you referenced the code there, and I'm not sure how all this syncs up to your bill, but I'm looking at a list of the federal conditions that we don't receive payment for, and there's more on your list. So have we targeted additional conditions for non-payment because they're very expensive and preventable? Or
as far as I know, Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson Rope, this either tracks with the Medicare standards today or the Medicare standards that are about to be adopted.
Okay. So yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator may still be impending then, because I'm looking at a current list. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Berglund, is there anybody who wishes to testify with concerns? Is there anybody who had any comments about the bill? Not Senator Berglund. Move Senate File
460 as amended be recommended to pass on the first meeting.
On that motion, any further discussion? Oh, do you want to speak with concerns?
5 minutes.
Sorry.
Made a comment on the amendment for
okay.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
That the meeting is adjourned.
Yay.
Yeah. Going to lessons now?
He's been a long day.
This is going to be, I have two judiciary like every freaking okay. It's beautiful to work with it, Barb. Barb, look, I pretty?
It
needs to be because your scarf there. She said, put it on my desk, I think.
Yes, sir. Okay. I have a question because we're looking at implementations of And this is what they're saying, and I'm not.
No, it doesn't say.